Good Friday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you've joined us today. Coming up on the program this hour, Mr. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air will be with us, talking about some of the big stories of the day. Also, Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms, the NRA getting rid of the women's division in its competitive shooting championships. This is because there's no reason to have separate divisions. Everybody can compete equally. This is a bold move, I think, but a good one. We'll talk with Jen Jakes about it later in the hour. Lance Toland of Lance Toland Associates joins us on the program next hour. His workplace, they've got three offices there in the state of Georgia, is a place where everybody has a firearm. Lance wants all of his employees to get their concealed carry license, and then Lance actually buys them a firearm. How's that working out? He said pretty well, but looking forward to talking with Lance next hour. Will Creeley of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education will join us on the program next hour. You know, we've got professors at the University of Texas and elsewhere in the Lone Star State who are trying to leave, who are saying that the passage of a campus carry is going to chill speech on college campuses. They want no part of it, while they ignore the chilling of speech that is actually taking place on college campuses. You know, you could go look at what happened in Utah, for instance, more than a decade ago when campus carry was passed and put into effect, or in Colorado, where it went into effect at Colorado State University 2003. Colorado Boulder got sued because they weren't complying with the law, and so they adopted campus carry a little bit later. You can't find stories of professors leaving, freaking out, saying that they're so concerned about who these concealed carry holders might be that they don't want to meet students or talk to them about anything controversial. You won't find that. It didn't happen. You also won't find any issues with campus carry when it was put into effect in these states. But in Texas this year, it's a little different. You again have professors who are saying that they'll sue, professors who are saying they're leaving town, they're leaving the state, because the very people who they were interacting with in the open spaces of campus, because campus, it's been legal for concealed carry holders to carry in the open spaces of campus. Now that they're going to be able to go inside a building, holy cow, I got to get out of the state. And again, at the same time on college campuses around the country, we really are seeing the chilling of speech. We saw it in California yesterday where protesters pulled the fire alarm, tried to prevent students from entering the room where Ben Shapiro was giving a talk. Ben Shapiro. Yes, the dangerous mind of Ben Shapiro. And Will is talking about some students at the University of South Carolina who were interrogated basically by the university for organizing a free speech event in the free speech zone. In Hour 3, Brad Slager, writing at The Federalist on Hollywood's hypocritical love-hate relationship with guns. We've talked about this on the program before as well, right? The idea that we've got the Oscars coming up this weekend where we will celebrate the art of filmmaking. And art is supposed to move us, right? Art is supposed to have an impact on us. It is supposed to change us. If it's good art, it is supposed to affect you. But this same industry says, but if you're talking about, you know, a bad effect, like when we have a really violent movie or glamorized drug use or whatever. It doesn't happen. Come on. This is sheer entertainment. This isn't, there's no way that what we do might influence someone's thoughts or behavior. Right? All of a sudden, it's not art at all. It's not supposed to move you. It's not supposed to do anything than mindlessly entertain you. And then when the movie's over, you don't think about it anymore. Right? So there is a, generally speaking, I think that there is a an unwillingness to simply accept that, yeah, what you do is supposed to have an impact, for better or for worse. And this is one of the areas, one of the chief areas in which we see this play out. So we'll talk with Brad about it coming up in Hour 3. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News, coming up in Hour 3 on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. We have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. Our Deal of the Day, our Good Guy of the Day, coming up at the top of Hour 3 as well. In Kansas last night, we had a individual apparently who had been served with a restraining order decide to kill as many people as possible. Cedric Larry Ford is the suspect's name. Sheriff T. Walton of Harvey County confirming that this protection from abuse order had been issued to Cedric Larry Ford, who came into his place of employment, Excel Industries, in Heston, Kansas, after 5 p.m. And began shooting. Ford, a convicted felon with what's described as a lengthy criminal history, could be our deal of the day when we learn more specifics about the criminal history, was engaged and killed by a police officer about 20 minutes after police arrived on scene and began searching the complex for the suspect. The sheriff says he was randomly shooting people and said it could have been much worse if not for the police department officer who confronted and killed the suspect. The sheriff said that particular officer is the hero out of all this. There's probably 200 or 300 more people still in that plant. That guy was not going to stop shooting. Again, information is still starting to, you're still continuing to come out about the suspect in this case. The sheriff acknowledged that the suspect had, quote, said he's been in my jail a couple of times before. But he did not say for what exactly, nor did they reveal details of the protection from abuse order that had been issued. We know that his social media, his Facebook pages, apparently showed him with guns, even though he was on probation in at least cases out of Florida. But again, the suspect in this case, Cedric Larry Ford, and as we learn more about this case, learn more about the suspect, learn more about the victims, we will let you know. But in the meantime, please do keep the families and the community in your thoughts and your prayers. We'll be talking again about this throughout the afternoon as we learn more information. Also have news out of Washington, D.C. this afternoon, where the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals has rejected an appeal by the District of Columbia to rehear en banc a case dealing with the district's gun control laws. This was a decision handed down, 2-1 decision handed down several months ago in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, throwing out some of the district's gun control requirements for prospective gun owners. The Washington Post says a majority of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit voted against rehearing the case as a full panel. That would be, you know, that en banc review The decision upholds an earlier three-judge ruling that knocked down D.C.'s one-gun-per-month law while upholding the government's authority, the Washington Post writes, to issue gun regulations that promote public safety. So there were several provisions that were thrown out. Judge Patricia Millett wrote that the city had failed to fully show in court some of the registration requirements, particularly a 15-question test on local gun laws, were sufficiently related to the government's interest in promoting public safety. She wrote that the district had failed that task. Washington Post says the court's 2-1 ruling in September upheld as constitutional many of the district's registration rules, such as requirements for fingerprinting and a 1-hour firearm safety course, but the decision eliminated the city's prohibition on registering more than one gun a month, as well as the test on D.C.'s gun laws. Washington Post says a spokesperson for the D.C. Attorney General says that the office is considering options for possible next steps. Well, the next step that would be available to the District of Columbia would be an appeal to the Supreme Court. That's the option that's available to them. And keep in mind, again, about one in every 10,000 cases or so is accepted by the Supreme Court. Supreme Court is still meeting. They will still be hearing cases. They will still be issuing decisions. With an 8-member court, if there is a 4-4 tie, then the decision of the lower court stands. So if the district were to appeal this to the Supreme Court, if the court were to hear this case before there was a replacement for Antonin Scalia, who was confirmed by the Senate, then you would need to get 5 of the 8 justices to overturn this ruling by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. A 4-4 split would simply affirm the lower court's decision or would let that lower court's decision stand, remain in place. Again, tossing out some of these requirements where the judge said the district could not show that there was a relationship to the government's interest in promoting public safety. In other words, there were some requirements that they had put in place. They couldn't really and did not justify, according to the court. The decision today has, here's a quote again from Judge Millett. It bears emphasizing the procedural posture of this case and the shortcomings in the record. The district, as a summary judgment movement, elected both to face summary judgment and to fend off Heller's own cross motion for summary judgment on a record of the district's own choosing. Given our prior remand order, moreover, the district had a full opportunity to develop a record and come forward with summary judgment qualifying evidence to substantiate the difficult policy judgments that it presses on rehearing and to do so to the degree necessary to survive the intermediate scrutiny that our precedent requires. By the way, again, this was not strict scrutiny that these laws reviewed under. This was intermediate scrutiny, which is that much broader, some might say even vaguer, a judicial review in which you only have to show again some, you know, general relationship between the law in question and the motive, you know, the governmental interest, in this case, of public safety. And you don't really have to show that it's narrowly tailored. It could just have, you know, some application to public safety. Judge says District of Columbia didn't even do that. As the majority opinion explains, with respect to those provisions that this court could not sustain, and especially with respect to the district's testing of knowledge about local firearms laws, the district failed that task. In my view, given those omissions in the district summary judgment record, this case simply does not present the broadside on regulatory authority to promote public safety that the en banc petition asserts. So judge says district, in essence, didn't do its homework. Didn't present the argument and the evidence that it needed to present to possibly have this case heard en banc by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So in the medium term, anyway, it looks like these laws are going to remain challenged. whether or not the district decides to pull back, maybe try to revise their laws once again. They seem to be in a almost constant process of revising their laws based on lawsuits about their restrictions on law-abiding gun owners. And it may be that that's exactly what happens here, that they retrench, they redesign their ordinances, they put them back out there to see what they get sued over this time. Or, again, they could try to appeal this case up to the U.S. Supreme Court. We will certainly be keeping our eyes on this story out of the D.C. Circuit Appeals, Circuit Court of Appeals as well. And when we come back after a quick timeout, Mr. Ed Morrissey at Hot Air is going to join us on the program. Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms will join us later in the hour as well. Stick around. We have much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed and Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh,
so
I'm glad here.
Tell us, what is Armed and Heels all about?
So Armed and Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed and Heels to support the working woman, the empowered women, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried, you were terrified. Was that before or after your shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried, and then he put it away. And
I see.
Maybe took 2 years to get the guts to do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No way.
So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. It seems you have it figured out. I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed and Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed and Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Speaking with Barry Woods with the National Wild Turkey Federation. Welcome to NRA News. How are you, Barry?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. We love National Wild Turkey Federation. You guys are a great organization. But, Barry, for those who don't know, who are watching us, what is National Wild Turkey Federation? What do you guys do?
We are in the business right now of creating hunters. We just started a new initiative called Save the Habitat, Save the Hunt. And over the course of the next 10 years through our volunteer base, we're going to create 1.5 million new hunters.
That's awesome. Why did you guys feel it was necessary to do this?
Because, unfortunately, hunter numbers are on a decline, and we recognized right away that if we're going to continue this heritage of the outdoors, that we're going to have to get kids off the couch, away from video games, and back into the outdoors. So, and we've also learned that several folks have gotten out of hunting for a number of different reasons, lack of access, lease prices, and things like that. So that's the other side of the initiative, is the habitat side, and we want to open access to 500,000 acres to help those people that we create to be hunters have a place to hunt.
That sounds great. So how are you going to go about doing this? You talked about opening access. What else is in the plan?
The other thing we're doing right now is what we're calling R3 is retention, recruitment, and reactivation. And we're also holding events across the country through our volunteer base where entire families can get involved in the shooting sports. We realized real quick that Pittman-Robertson Act and the way that it works in conservation is very important to the hunting heritage. And so we got to get these folks back engaged in the outdoors. So they can get to our website at nwtf.org.
Tell folks, why should they check out your website in this new initiative?
If you want to play a role in getting hunters and recruiting hunters and becoming a volunteer with the NWTF, it's going to take a workforce. It's going to take a lot of people coming on board and helping us achieve this mission. And so if you're interested in that, you need to get on our website.
Welcome back. to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Those of you tuning in online right now, looking at a shot from across the Potomac River, we'll be across the river a week from today, actually a week from yesterday, heading to CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. And 1 week from today, Mr. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air, going to be sitting in with us for an entire hour. Ed, I'm excited about this.
I am, too. It's going to be a lot of fun. You guys have a great booth every year at CPAC. I think it's going to be we're going to have a great time there.
It'll be I think we're like right at the intersection. If we are where we were last year, right at the intersection of two big hallways, so we can actually watch the Jets and the Sharks congregate right in front of us, Ed.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome there. That little congregation thing there. It was a great setup. It was a great location.
Absolutely. Looking forward to seeing you there next week. What do you think this is going to come, you know, after Super Tuesday? We were talking with Jim Garrity from National Review yesterday to sort of set the CPAC scene. And what do you think the big storylines? I mean, obviously, the presidential election is going to be key. I guess one of the big questions will be, what will the presidential race look like post Super Tuesday, right?
Well, it's a good question, because right now it's hard to see. We just had a debate last night, which may or may not shake things up a little bit. But right now, Trump is looking like he is in pretty much control across the board. There is some question about whether he's got a lead in Texas, or whether Cruz has got a lead in Texas, or whether all three of these guys are bunched up together within the margin of error. I've seen polls that look all three of those ways. So I think Texas is really interesting, but overall, you know, Trump's got a pretty good lead. These are all proportional allocation primaries and caucuses right now. So the top three guys are going to wind up with delegates, at least the top three guys. There may be a possibility that John Kasich can get some delegates out of Massachusetts or Vermont, I think was the other one, where he was actually not performing too badly. But for the most part, you're going to see the delegates get split up, you know, Trump and then either Rubio and Cruz or Cruz and Rubio. But all three of them are going to get significant delegate counts. And the question will be, after that, how much of a lead does Donald Trump have going into the contest where it starts becoming winner-take-all? Because according to the RNC rules, it can't have winner-take-all until after March 15th. South Carolina was a somewhat of an exception. But other than that, everything else has to be proportionally allocated. After March 15th, you have Florida. March 14th, excuse me, is the deadline. So March 15th is Florida,
mm-hmm.
and that's a winner-take-all state. And that's for Marco Rubio's home state. And right now, polls are showing different things. There was a poll floating around yesterday. I think it was from Quinnipiac, you know, obviously a very reliable poll, or at least a respectable pollster that showed Trump with, I think it was like a 16-point lead in Florida. Obviously, Rubio doesn't see that way. Doesn't see that race that way. But, I mean, if you take a look at the Real Clear Politics polling, that's the way it's kind of breaking out. I mean, I don't see another poll there where there isn't a double-digit lead for Trump over Rubio, and Rubio's in second place. But, you know, at some point, Rubio has to win a state, and if he doesn't win Florida, pretty much that's, I think, game over for Rubio at that point.
Talking again with Ed Morrissey of Hot Air, and, you know, it's interesting, looking at some of the polls, Ed, I think, semi-successfully weaned myself from constantly checking Real Clear Politics every day and looking at the latest polls. And in part, it's because of stuff like this. Like, here are two polls, South Carolina Democratic presidential primary, Emerson College, Hillary Clinton 60, Bernie Sanders 37, Hillary Clinton by 23 points, Clemson University survey, Clinton 64, Sanders 14, Clinton by 50. Now, you know, I suppose you could say, Ed, in both those polls, Hillary Clinton has a substantial lead. But there's a heck of a lot of difference between a 23-point lead and a 50-point lead. And this is...
And I think the 50-point lead is kind of ridiculous, but... But look, I mean, that's the reason why RCP makes such a good tool, is because they try to stay within polls whose methodologies are, you know, reasonable and explicable, and then you get an average over, I think it's a 30-day average in the polling, if I'm not mistaken, and it kind of gives you an idea where things are at. But I mean, if you take a look at Florida, And I know that Marco was on TV today on all three broadcast networks, continuing his attack on Donald Trump. And he was asked about this Quinnipiac poll, and he said, "Well, that's not what we're seeing. That's one poll. It's not what we're seeing with our own internal polling and that sort of thing." And maybe true. I mean, maybe his own internal polling is showing something different. But take a look at the last four polls, and Trump is up 16, 20, 19, and 12, and that's it. I mean, that's there's nothing indicating that it's a lower. You know, that it's a lower lead. You have to go back to the 1st of November or the beginning, towards the beginning of November, to find a poll that shows Trump in single-digit lead in Florida. So the thing is that I think if you're looking at this across a broad spectrum of polling, there seems to be a problem in Florida. Now, last night's debate may turn things around, and Florida isn't going to vote for, another 3 weeks or so. So, or 2.5 weeks. So there's time for things to change in Florida. I don't know how much time there is for things to change between now and Tuesday in the SEC primary. You know, there's the southern primaries, primarily the southern primaries that will take place on Tuesday. So, I mean, even if the debate impacts Donald Trump, I don't know how much time it's going to, that there is left for that to resonate into the voting decisions that are going to take place on Tuesday.
All right, so let's use this, Ed, to kind of segue to your new book, which is coming out April 12th, Going Red, The 2 Million Voters Who Will Elect an Ex-President and How Conservatives Can Win Them. Because I'm curious, we've talked about the book, the fact that it's coming out, but we haven't explored a lot. Are you allowed to talk a little bit about the book?
Absolutely. I can talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Okay, good. Because I know when the Heavy Lifting was coming out, we were kind of told, like, okay, don't talk too much about it. we got to get the word out there a little bit, but wait more until the book is closer to the release date. So I don't want to, ruin anything, but I am curious. The 2 million voters that you're talking about here, obviously they're, I'm guessing, not equally distributed around the country, right? They where are they clustered? Where are these people located?
Well, what I did, what Going Red does, is it goes to 7 swing states that are really up for grabs in the 2016 election, or at least you hope they will be. These are states that Republicans used to win that they don't win any longer, with one exception. And states that they absolutely have to win if they want to win the next presidential election. So that's Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, Virginia, Colorado, New Hampshire, and I think Wisconsin. I put Wisconsin in there because I think Wisconsin's winnable for Republicans. There's been a lot of changes in Wisconsin over the last few years, and I think Wisconsin is a winnable state. It's got 10 electoral votes, which makes it a pretty nice win if Republicans can convert it. And then what I did was I looked at a significant bellwether county in each of these states that went for George Bush in 2004, but went for Obama in 2008 and Obama again in 2012, again with one exception on 2012, and tried to figure out how Republicans lost these counties and what's changed in the counties since then and how Republicans need to win these counties back again. So that's where the 2 million voters who will elect the next president comes from. That construct comes from the fact that we're looking at roughly about 2 million voters in those 7 swing counties, bellwether counties in these swing states, whose decision will either drive the state decision or the state result, or will be a bellwether for the state result. And the thing about these counties is that they're also bellwethers for larger, a larger look about demographics, about messaging, about ground game. There's lots of things that are going on in this book, and so that's the reason why Going Red focuses on and the subtitle focuses on the 2 million voters. But what this is really about is are we going to be a national party, or are we going to be locked into a regional, a regional base party that can never break out into the purple states?
Talking again with Ed Morrissey from Hot Air about his new book, Going Red. And so, Ed, I'm guessing, again, in these 7 states and these 7 bellwether counties that you're looking at, Obviously, there are a lot of differences, but were there what were the similarities? What were the commonalities? I mean, how do you speak to? Is there a way to speak to generally that group that you've identified that cuts across?
Well, there's some interesting commonality.
Yeah.
And one of the big commonalities is the fact that the demographics have shifted in all of these counties, except for maybe one, so that it looks less like it did when Republicans were dominating and more like America's demographics as a whole. And so this is sort of a bellwether of a different kind, because Republicans have to find a way to compete, with Hispanic voters, with Black voters, especially, with younger voters, especially. And they have to find a way to reach those people, and they have to find a way to get to back to finding out who these voters are and finding out what their issues are and showing them how the Republican and conservative agenda can address those problems better than the alternative that they're being given. And we didn't do that in 2008. We didn't do it in 2012 either. We relied on national messaging that had nothing to do with local communities and paid a huge price for it. And I think in 2012 was a winnable election, and we lost it that way.
You know, so, okay, so is it a messaging problem, or is it a policy problem?
It's a messaging problem. It's a ground game problem. It is a outreach problem. It is a resource problem. And it is a candidate problem. It's all of those things. I mean, all of these things go into going red. And so this is something that Republican Party has already started to understand about itself. But I don't know that Republican voters and conservative activists understand it yet. And you still hear people talking about, well, you got to get the base out. You got to get the base out. And what people don't understand is that you can't win national elections that way. You can win congressional elections that way. But generally speaking, Republicans are very good at running local campaigns at the congressional level, at the state legislative level, and even statewide elections. They've done really well. They've elected governors. We've got more governors now than we've had in a very long time. We've got more control of more state legislatures than we've had since Herbert Hoover. So Republicans on the ground know how to do this, but national campaigns generally don't. And the Obama campaign was extremely successful at this by basically running a 435 district congressional election in both presidential elections.
This is fascinating. I'm going to have to, if you've got any extra galley copies lying around, Ed, you've got to send one my way.
Well, actually, we have some coming your way.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, excellent.
Yeah, we got two coming your way, one for you and one for Cameron Gray, so.
Oh, good, because I just finished a book, and now I'm dying to read this.
I'll bet it's in your mail, and you know what you need to do when you get that? You need to take a picture and tweet it out. GoingRedBook.com.
I can do that. GoingRedBook.com. And it's interesting because this is such a this is such a bizarre election year, I think all of the paid pundits and the people who are supposed to be very smart and be able to explain the American people, I think, you know, in many cases they are now left with just saying the American people are stupid. There's your explanation. Because in many cases they've gotten it really wrong, Ed. I love the fact that this book is actually focused on the American voter.
And here's the thing. I mean, you can say, oh, well, look, people are dumb and they're making a dumb choice. But basically, and this is something I think we just probably didn't give enough credit to earlier on, is this rampant populism. You talked to Selena Zito at the Tribune Review, mm-hmm. And she's had her finger on that pulse for a very long time and warned about this. And that gets to the fact that you've got really two political parties. I mean, I talk about in Going Red, I talk about the Republican Party, but really you've got two political parties that don't talk to voters anymore. The reason why Obama was able to do it is because Obama had to build that machine himself, and he did. He was very good at it. I mean, I have to tell you, I spent months on the road researching this, talked to over 100 people about this, and at the end of it, I came to a strange new respect for Barack Obama's organizational abilities. I think we made mistake after mistake in underestimating him. And what you've got left now is you've got two political parties that don't talk to the voters that they're trying to reach. They're parsing them out using, you know, data mining that doesn't have anything to do with what their hopes, dreams, and aspirations are, what their local issues are.
We're more than an algorithm, right? I mean, that's ultimately it. You can't try to just define us as analytics and expect that you're going to really understand voters. Particularly
exactly.
If you do stop talking to real voters and you decide, well, we've got all the data tools that we need. You know, that's the thing. I mean, that is important, though, Ed, is what you're saying. You do have to have that sort of data stream, right? It is important to have more than just a message, more than just the policies. You do have to have the technology as well.
Yes.
But that doesn't get rid of the importance of the actual connection with the voter.
No, and this is what the mistake Republicans were making is they thought Obama's got a Facebook page, so let's get a Facebook page. Obama has a Twitter account, let's get a Twitter account. What they didn't realize is that they were using that to identify real people on the ground and turn them into their allies and ambassadors so that those people would talk to other real people on the ground. And they found all these people. They put together a really complex organization to drive that. You know, that's community organizing, right? I mean, it's something Republicans sort of have a field day talking about Obama's background, but that's what that is. That's what that is. He knew it. Now, the upside for Republicans is that the Democratic Party didn't do that. Obama did it. So that means when Obama leaves, the Democratic Party basically hasn't built that machine. And in the book Going Red, I talk a little bit about whether or not the Republicans are building that machine. I think readers might be a little surprised to hear how that's going along right now. And that's also in goingredbook.com.
All right. Listen, Ed, I am really looking forward to spending some more time with you next week. Thank you, as always, for coming on the program today.
My pleasure. Always great talking with you. Can't wait to see you at CPAC. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you soon. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. Again, the new book, Going Red. Let's take a quick timeout. When we come back, Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms will join us on the program. We've got some news out of Virginia to tell you about after a break as well. So stick around. There's much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up next.
I'm speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV. Jana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So I follow you on social media, mm-hmm. and I always see, you know, you're out. Geez, you're everywhere. So I'm glad you had a chance to sit down and talk to us for a minute. But you use Nosler ammunition, and Nosler is our primary underwriting sponsor for NRA News Cam and Company. So I've been dying to get to sit down with you to talk a little bit about that. So tell us, how did you form this relationship with Nosler using their stuff?
Absolutely. Well, Jim Kinsey, my boyfriend and executive producer of Skullbound TV, he had a relationship with Nosler, a previous relationship. He introduced me. I'm from the Midwest, from Wisconsin.
I couldn't tell by the accent.
I know.
You betcha.
You betcha. He introduced me to Nosler about 6 years ago, and that is literally the only ammunition I have used. For all six seasons of Skullbound TV, we're filming right now for season six, and it's just so incredibly accurate and dependable. I did a really neat episode this year. You know, Nosler was founded on one of their moose hunts gone bad years ago, the ammunition, not on Nosler ammunition, but,
right.
You know, they founded the ammunition company because they needed something more reliable after this bad encounter with a moose hunt. And I ended up drawing an incredible moose tag, went into Alaska, do it yourself, rented the horses, packed in, ended up just being blessed with a 64-inch bull moose.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, those Nosler bullets did the trick.
And I'll tell you what, Janet, whether you're hunting like you do, mm-hmm. shooting competitively, you know, this is probably, if not outside the firearm, the most important thing to be a successful shooter.
It really is. I mean, a lot of things can go wrong, but it's so nice when you realize that, you know, especially like with a moose or an elk, they're such big animals. You need your ammunition to perform beautifully. And I got into long-range shooting about 3 years ago. I've trained with some of the best sniper champions, world champions. They all use Nosler as well. And it just when you can take out, you know, a lot of things can grow on you. And, of course, you need to plug in all your ballistics, and you've got wind and altitude and all these things. But when you have ammo that you can count on to perform the way it's supposed to, and, you know, when it says it's, you know, their ballistics are what they say it is, it's just a beautiful thing.
It takes out one of those nagging variables, whether the weather, the, you know, that's so great. Speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV about Nosler. So let's shift gear a little bit and talk a little bit about what's going on with Skullbound. How long have you been doing the show?
We are airing season 5 right now. It's amazing. Cool. I'm so blessed.
So going from when you started to now, did you ever think that this would be happening?
I really didn't. I did not. I didn't foresee the success that it would have, and we just feel so blessed that things have come together the way they have. Our hunts have gone well. I feel even more lucky to have the platform for my personal conservation causes, because conservation is a very passionate topic to me. We always include a conservation piece on every episode, but it's also given me the platform to start taking veterans out hunting, and it's been seriously some of the most fulfilling moments of my life. I took another Army veteran double amputee out this year on his first elk hunt, and he got his bull on day 2, and there were tears all around. And I have to say, when I told Nosler that I was taking another Army hero out, they built him the gun. They gave him the ammo. You know, they have been such a tremendous supporter of Skullbound TV and our veterans. And it just is one more reason I'm so proud to be partnered with them.
And it's something I've been following, too. We've had you on before with Cam a number of times talking about that. I follow it on social media. It's so great that you do that. And isn't it great to have it's a great agenda to have to begin with, if you ask me, but to have a vehicle like this, you know. Yeah. Some of us are very lucky and blessed that we get to do what we do.
Right.
And to me, you're doing such great work. So
it's a way to say thank you. And, you know, here I am in a woman in the greatest country in the world. I'm able to pursue my dreams, and I'm able to, you know, have a house full of guns, if you will, because of these men and women. And it's just a way to give back to them. And it's a wonderful platform to have that we don't take lightly.
Jana Waller, how can we get more information about you? Where do we got to go?
You can go to skullboundtv.com. Super simple. We also have a lot of information on the Sportsman's Channel website, but we're on Big Game Wednesday nights. I'm happy to be a part of this industry.
Jana Waller, thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. All right, in Virginia, Governor Terry McAuliffe signing the reciprocity bill that restores reciprocity with all of these states that Virginia had reciprocity with. But in addition to restoring that reciprocity, the legislation also requires the Virginia State Police to enter into reciprocal agreements with other states where needed. Chris Cox, executive director of NRA's Institute for Legislative Action, says now more than 6 million law-abiding gun owners will be free to travel in and out of Virginia with their Second Amendment rights intact. Self-defense is a fundamental right that must be respected. He said concealed carry permit holders are among the safest groups of citizens in Virginia and throughout the country. On behalf of the NRA's more than 5 million members, we commend this effort to protect public safety and fundamental freedoms. Hopefully this effort will encourage Congress to pass national right to carry reciprocity legislation as soon as possible. So there you go. Some good news out of the state of Virginia. I want to welcome to the program right now. Jen Jakes will be heading to the state of Virginia here before long. So congratulations, because reciprocity with Wisconsin was one of those states that, that was one of the things that disappeared with Attorney General Mark Herring's order. And so now we've got reciprocity again.
Well, thanks. Now I can bring my guns down next month. That's a good thing.
It is a very good thing. I appreciate you coming on the program today. How are you?
I'm good. The kids are home because we have parent-teacher conferences. I hesitated, yes.
You did. You're like, I'll be honest. Yeah, no.
I'm great.
Okay. Great, yeah. Fantastic. Well, I hope they're enjoying the 3-day weekend. It seems kind
they are enjoying it much more than their mother.
It seems kind of unfair that they would let the kids out of school for anything other than a snow day this time of year. You know, like if you have to, I understand, but really? You don't have the parent-teacher conferences at night? It's during the day?
Well, I had middle daughters last night and little daughters this morning, so.
Wow.
Yeah, whatever. Well, I did bring her teacher a coffee, so.
Oh, good for you. Little bribe there. Never hurts.
Right.
Listen, I thought this piece that you had at Bearing Arms was really, really interesting here. You talked with HQ Moody. The MNRA getting rid of the women's division in its shooting championships, right?
It's pretty cool, right? I thought feminists would be up in arms with my headline of NRA eliminating women's division in shooting championships, but apparently they don't read Bearing Arms very often, which is fine. But, right, they started the women's category, 70 years ago? And that's because there were a lot of military shooters and the guys were just far and away blowing the gals away. And what was it, last year? In each of the two aggregate matches, female shooters placed first. So it's amazing. And thank you, NRA, for recognizing that we have absolutely leveled the playing field.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, it was nearly 70 years ago that the women's category introduced to the small bore championships. HQ Moody says there's a high degree of parity between men and women shooters in the small bore championship. Small bore committees discussed making the championships gender equitable for many years and finally felt it was the right time to implement the change. One would think, you know, again, as you say, that perhaps some quote-unquote progressive forces would be cheering about this, Jen, but I don't think they're allowed to cheer about things like this.
I don't think they're a very cheerful bunch in general, but I got to tell you, I am cheering for this. I think it's pretty darn cool that we've not only caught up to the boys, but we're beating them. And way to go, girl.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, look, we've been talking about this, I think, with you for several months now, the fact that, you know, when you talk about women are the fastest growing segment of the firearms industry, that is true. But it also makes it still sound like they're a niche part of the gun owning community,
right?
And they're not. They're not.
No.
There is no stereotypical gun owner anymore. There just isn't.
And I also think that women, you know, we're not only, I shouldn't say that, women have been shooting this whole time. We're just now stepping into being full-fledged and just gun owners and mm-hmm. really embracing not only being a gun owner, but getting concealed carry permits and just basically not depending on men for everything else. And I think that's great. And like I said, we've been shooting for a long time, and I'm a prime example myself, Cam. You know this. I grew up in a hunting family, but I had never hunted until a few years ago.
Right.
My husband, you know, my dad, everybody has handguns and great, fine, whatever, but I never had my own, and now I have my own. I have a concealed carry permit. I'm taking training, and it's just I'm kind of the status quo in this movement where, yes, I know firearm safety. I've been around guns. I know how to shoot guns. But now I'm a gun owner, and now I'm a responsibly carrying citizen. And it's great that more women are speaking out and really moving into this pattern of being responsibly armed.
Absolutely. And I think I just think it's cool, too, that you are seeing, again, that level of competition, you know, be so equitable. And it says, I think, a lot that we've got more people who are competing and who are getting into the shooting sport. Certainly, you know, I think more Americans are carrying firearms for self-defense. That goes for women as well. But, you know, the fact that we're now also seeing more women hunt, and we're seeing that growth in these shooting sports at the high school level. You know, a trap shooting is one of the fastest growing high school sports right now for boys and girls. I love stuff like that. I think that's fantastic.
Oh, me too. I actually took a local girl skeet shooting, and she had never, ever done it before. She had never shot a shotgun before. And she was completely addicted. She said, oh, my gosh, I cannot wait to go home. I want to take a bunch of my girlfriends. I want to run a course. She could not wait. And to see that excitement in her and light that fire, and now you know that she's going to go back to her friends and say, we should go shoot skeet or we should go run. You know, that's just neat because you're pushing more women into shooting sports in general. And then, yes, hopefully competition.
Absolutely. Talking with Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms. Now, are you or are you not going to be at CPAC next week? Do you know yet?
I am.
You are.
I am.
Well, get
ready,
CPAC.
I've never been there before. This is quite the year to step into it, isn't it, Cam?
It really is. I made a another Sharks and Jets joke to Ed Morrissey, but I don't think he got it earlier in the program, because where our booth is, it's sort of at the intersection of two hallways, and I said it's going to be great because that's where the Sharks and the Jets will congregate. So I'm hoping that the various factions all have learned like show tunes, and we get some singing and dancing, as opposed to just yelling and shouting at the various contingents there in the hallways.
I will be there snapping my fingers and doing my best Ethel Merman just for you.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate that. Now, CPAC is going to be very interesting this year. Coming, right after Super Tuesday. I know. Be excited about it. This is your first time going. You'll have a great time. Really do.
I keep telling myself that.
You will. You will. Trust me. You'll hear some fantastic speakers. You will meet some great grassroots activists from all around the country. It is a really good time. It really is. I think the passions are going to be very high this year, but I think it'll still be a good time.
That's what I'm worried about. The passions are, they're ramped up.
They are. Well, there's a lot to be passionate about,
There is. That is true.
I think that is true. I would much rather have a passionate electorate with whom I disagree with some percentage than a apathetic electorate.
I will give you that 110%. You are right. At least we have people who are engaged and actively seeking information, and so you're right. That is a good thing.
You're right. I mean, if we had record low turnout this year,
that would not be good.
That would concern me. I'm okay with record high turnout. So, it's boisterous. It's completely unexpected. I don't think any of the pundits and any of the experts are experts this year. I think that they are as amateur as the rest of us.
I keep saying this whole process has been a complete crapshoot. Like, if you think you know what's going to happen, wrong.
Yeah, which I think is what is driving so many of the commentariat class crazy, because it's their job
to analyze. Right.
Absolutely, it's their job to analyze the American people, and the American people keep confounding them, and so they just are left now, I think, in many cases with the Americans are stupid argument, and I don't think that's a very good argument. I don't think it explains what's actually happening.
Right. No, and I think it's a lot of anti-establishment. I think it's a lot of, hey, something needs to change, but we don't quite know what it is. It's a lot of, it's a lot.
It's
We're
going
to leave it at that. It's a lot. It's a lot.
But you're
and
right.
And I actually, my son said, he goes, are you looking forward to it? And I said, I'm a little bit nervous. I feel like I have less of a chance getting shot in the firearms industry than I do in the political arena right now, honestly, because it's so... Whew. I mean, they're really worked up.
Everybody is. But, I do think that, you're going to have a great time. You will.
Oh, I'm sure.
And it'll be, it really is something to see. We were up in Harrisburg. It's funny, going from the Great American Outdoor Show to the Conservative Political Action Conference, because it's about as different an event as you could possibly get.
Really?
Opposites? Yeah. But it's okay, because to me it always shows just how broad this issue really is.
Right.
That it's everything from the policy discussions and the political side to the in Harrisburg the practical side, the exercise of our right to keep and bear arms. So it's two sides of the same coin, but very, very different. Yeah.
Well, I've done both. I've picked up a gun and I've applied for a concealed carry permit, and I've also gone door knocking and done a lot of political work. So this will be interesting for me. Absolutely. I'm sure I'll learn a lot.
Listen, we're looking forward to seeing you there. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Thank you. I clean when I get stressed out or nervous, and my health is looking pretty good right about now.
Oh, well, there you go. At least you got that going for you. All right, Jen,
exactly.
Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. You too. Love to the goats.
I'll try to put up some new video this weekend. My pleasure. Jen Jakes joins us from Bearing Arms. It's hard. It's hard to get the video of the cute baby goats because I get home, it's dark, can't take them outside, and they can hop on the couch now. That's their they have gotten big enough that they can hop up on the couch. But I start taking videos, or I try to take videos, and they immediately bounce over to my feet, and you get like a second and a half of that, and then you get 10 seconds of them kind of trying to climb up my legs. So this weekend, you can check out the Instagram feed, and hopefully we'll have some baby goats romping around and frolicking outside. Lance Tolan of Lance Tolan Associates is going to join us on the program next hour. His is the office where everybody is armed. You may have seen this story going around this week down in Georgia. He's actually got three offices down in Georgia, but all of his employees have their concealed carry license. And Lance is actually buying them their firearm, or a firearm. Plus, Will Creeley of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education will join us on the program. We'll talk about the chilling of speech on campus, not by concealed carry holders, but by students and faculty who are actively trying to cut out people's First Amendment rights. Stick around. There is much more NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Joe Fiala with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. Joe, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for stopping by. You got a lot of stuff going on. I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you do in the Governor's Office of Economic Development there in South Dakota and why you do it. So tell us a little bit about what the office is all about and what you have going on.
Sure. So we're all about growing business in the state or attracting business to the state. And in my specific instance, I get to work with all of the companies in the shooting, hunting, and outdoor industry. So everything from firearms and ammunition to duck calls and fishing rods.
Wow, Joe, can we say dream job here?
Yeah, you can.
And it's great in South Dakota. There's an office to do this. Because, you know, Joe, in some states would say, I won't mention names, you know, it's okay. Maybe we'll keep you at arm's length. We love your taxes. But you guys are showing in a very overt way here, welcoming industries like this.
Absolutely. You know, it's such a good fit for the state in a couple of ways. And here's a couple of examples. We've got about 850,000 people in the state. And we issued 350,000 hunting licenses last year.
Say that again. Hold on.
Yeah. So we've got about 850,000 people in the state, and we issued 350,000 hunting licenses.
Wow. Dude, that is incredible.
Yeah. So this industry is a really good fit for the state. It's just culturally what we do,
yeah,
who we are.
Yeah, and you know, Joe, we're talking. Let's talk about that for a minute. I just was talking with some other folks here. And for people who are non-hunters and don't understand, it's part of a lifestyle, you know. It's part of, you know, who we are and what we do.
That's exactly right. You know, I grew up hunting with my dad and my mom, and we'd go out hunting, and now I get to teach my kids that same thing.
Right.
And it's about family time. It's about, you know, hunting for your table.
Yeah.
In some instances.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's about the sportsmanship.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, Joe, whether you grew up, I grew up in Pennsylvania. Hunting's big there. The day after Thanksgiving, when I grew up, it wasn't about going out Black Friday and shopping. It was going out deer hunting.
Exactly.
Or you grew up in South Dakota. That's just part of what our DNA is. Speaking with Joe Fiala, he is with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff, some of the folks you've been working with. Name some of the companies.
Right. So, you know, some of the South Dakota companies that have been longtime residents that continue to grow. You hear Dakota Arms.
Right.
Certainly. Black Hills Ammunition.
Absolutely.
Corbin Ammunition. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've got some of the players that have been around a long time. One of our newest corporate citizens to the state is a company out of Pennsylvania. It's called Lehigh Defense.
Okay,
and
I've heard them. Yep.
They are expanding to the state. And so it's a great fit. They're going to make bullets, and we'll use them.
How great is that? A company in Pennsylvania is expanding out to South Dakota.
Right.
How great is that?
Right.
All right, so we got about 30 seconds here, and then we have to wrap it up. So I want you to sort of give folks the message why they need to be, if they're in those particular industries you mentioned before, why do they need to bring their business to South Dakota?
Sure. Couple of things. One, we're a very low-tax state, which means we want the business owner to keep their money. Okay.
That's nice.
Yeah. Second thing is Forbes rated us number one as the lowest cost of business state in 2015.
That's nice, too.
Right. So it doesn't cost a lot to do business. And then the cultural fit that we talked about, it just works. And we want to grow that business in our state.
How can people get more information about what you do?
Right. They can go to our website. It's sdreadytowork.com.
Okay.
And then for my specific industry, you put a slash and shot.
Joe, thanks so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Lance Toland, he runs Lance Toland Associates down in Georgia. It is the insurance office where everybody has their concealed carry license. He'll join us on the program in just a few minutes. Will Creeley of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Join us talking about a case out of South Carolina where a couple of students at the University of South Carolina wanted to organize a free speech event in the designated free speech zone and instead ended up being questioned by the administration there. Why do you want to talk about, why do you want to highlight these examples here of free speech? What you got a problem? You agree with what was said here? You know, again, I am fascinated. In fact, why don't we talk about what's going on in Texas, where the dean of the architecture school at the University of Texas at Austin says he's leaving. He's heading to Pennsylvania, where they also, by the way, have concealed carry on the books. Now, they don't have campus carry, but he will still be interacting with concealed carry holders. But he is leaving to return to the University of Pennsylvania School of Design. Fritz Steiner is the dean of the Texas School of Architecture. He had previously taught at Pennsylvania. He had been in Texas since 2001, said he would not have considered leaving if not for campus carry. He said, I thought I would be responsible for enforcing a law I don't believe in. He said, I can report that it is already part of the conversation when I was trying to recruit and retain faculty and recruit graduate students. It is certainly on the minds of many faculty and students. He said he's not anti-gun, just doesn't want to see lawful, legal concealed carry holders there on campus. He said, I grew up hunting. My father was a Marine and a policeman. I'm not a stranger to firearms in any way. He said, I grew up believing that there was an appropriate place for guns and that it was not in a place of higher education and higher learning. You know, again, when Utah adopted its campus carry policies more than a decade ago, we didn't see this reaction from professors there. When Colorado adopted campus carry in 2003, again, Colorado University of Boulder, a little bit late to the party, had to be dragged kicking and screaming via lawsuit, but they eventually recognized it. But at Colorado State University, since 2003, campus carry has been on the books. And again, you didn't see this reaction. What you saw, actually, the number of reported crimes dropped from about 800 per year on campus to about 200 per year on campus. But you didn't see professors leave, say, well, we're not going to be able to attract any students. We're not going to be able to attract any faculty. As a matter of fact, I think Colorado State is still doing pretty well as a institution. It really wasn't until we got to Texas in this particular law that we have seen faculty say, well, I'm not going to teach here. Now, again, keep in mind, in the state of Texas, prior to the passage of Senate Bill 11, these professors, the ones who say, I'm leaving now because I don't think that these concealed carry holders have a place on a college campus, they were interacting with concealed carry holders on a college campus because Senate Bill 11 says that these concealed carry holders can lawfully and legally carry their firearms in buildings on campus. But prior to that, and currently, right now, concealed carry holders have been able to lawfully carry in the open spaces of college campuses. So I'm pretty sure that these professors have actually, you know, interacted with a concealed carry holder before now. But it is this bill that is prompting, again, the decision by some to leave the state and go somewhere else. Now, Students for Concealed Carry issued a statement yesterday criticizing educators, quote, overwhelmed by unjustified fear, saying intellectually these professors are no different than someone whose actions are defined by an irrational fear of sharks, witchcraft, or vaccines. It is interesting how with both of the professors, and I've heard of two that are leaving, one went to Australia, the other went to Pennsylvania, that with both of these professors, I saw a lot of interviews, I saw a lot of statements given, but I never saw the reporter ask the question, okay, so what about before the passage of this law? What about, you know, right now where people are lawfully carrying firearms? What about when you set foot off campus and you, you know, travel around the state of Texas where there are plenty of concealed carry holders? What about the fact that violent criminals don't really care what the policies of a campus might be, whether or not this is a gun-free zone or not? Again, we see stories of robberies occurring on college campuses and assaults on college campuses all the time. Yeah, despite the fact that these are places where you have a no-gun policy in place. I haven't actually seen any pushback from any of the reporters who have covered these professors. I don't want to say pushback, but just asking some questions that would require the professors to show that they've engaged in some critical thought on this, that that they recognize, that is true. You're right, but here's why I don't think that matters. I haven't seen any evidence that they've actually been confronted with any of these facts and asked to explain, all right, well, what do you think about, you know, X, Y, or Z? I do think it's interesting that, you know, again, on these college campuses, we're engaged in not just rigorous debate, but we're supposed to be looking at research, supposed to be looking at what happens, what has happened in other states that have adopted these laws. There doesn't seem to be that spirit of inquiry when it comes to campus carry. And, you know, again, when it comes to the chilling of speech, as we've seen the some of the educators at the University of Houston claim that campus carry is going to lead to the chilling of speech, that's already happening. Already happening. Again, we'll talk about it with Will Creeley coming up later on in the hour. I will have to ask Will about what happened yesterday at Cal State Los Angeles. KABC reported it this way. Ben Shapiro escorted by police from CSULA due to angry protesters. Sid Garcia, Tim Reardon reporting a controversial conservative commentator escorted by police from Cal State University, Los Angeles, as angry demonstrators protested his presence on campus Thursday afternoon. Ben Shapiro is scheduled to speak at the campus on Thursday. Editor-in-chief of the Daily Wire, editor-at-large of Breitbart News. Earlier in the week, CSULA President William Covino canceled the event, stating that he wanted to postpone the speech so that speakers with different viewpoints could also talk and allow the free exchange of ideas. By the way, how often does that happen when you have just a progressive speaker where the president says, well, hang on, because we want to make sure that we have some competing points of view here? Never happens, right? So the event was allowed to take place. Covino said yesterday that if Ben Shapiro showed up, that the university would allow him to speak. Ben Shapiro showed up. The university allowed him to speak, but some of the students there on campus didn't want to let Ben Shapiro speak. So they pulled a fire alarm. Shapiro kept talking. They blocked entrances to the student union where he was speaking. ABC 7 in Los Angeles says cameras captured shouting and pushing as intense interactions occur between protesters and those attempting to attend the event. After speaking for about an hour, Shapiro tweeted that he had to be escorted by police from the campus for safety concerns. Following the event, the Young Americans Foundation released a statement that said, in part, that Covino and campus administrators should be held accountable and that it would, quote, pursue all legal actions to do so. Several students who protested the event, now these are the protesters, said that they felt that the university president had thrust them in to a tense confrontation with supporters of Shapiro and then showed a lack of support afterwards. Did he compel them to go protest? That's kind of fascinating. Or was it just the fact that this was allowed to take place that meant he thrust them into this event? Again, we'll talk about it with Will Creeley from the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education later on in the hour. Coming up in Hour 3, Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense, Deal of the Day. Good guy of the day, plus Brad Sliger, writing at the Federalist, our friend Tony Katz. More news out of California, not dealing with the First Amendment and the freedom of speech, but dealing with our right to keep and bear arms. ABC 10 in California, Brad Kelman of the Desert Sun, says in the 7 weeks since terrorists killed 14 people in San Bernardino, requests for concealed carry permits have skyrocketed throughout the Inland Empire, leading to crippling backlogs and massive delays of the public safety agencies that process applications. We talked about what's been going on in Fresno County, where before the attacks in San Bernardino, the sheriff's department was processing applications in about 30 days. Now, or at least as of a couple of weeks ago, they have a backlog of about 10 months. I thought that was bad. But Brad Kelman reporting for the Desert Sun that San Bernardino County reported a 9-fold increase in concealed carry applications in the month that followed the terror attacks. In Riverside County, Kelman reports the permitting process is so backlogged that it now takes a year and a half to meet with an official to submit an application. They're saying you go down to the sheriff's department now and they'll tell you, okay, come back in August of 2017. We should be ready to talk to you then. Kelman says the spike is so pronounced that it has angered gun advocates and gun critics alike. To those who see the proliferation of firearms as a problem, another rush for guns is just the latest chapter in a tragically familiar story. To those who consider concealed weapons a constitutional right, says Brad Kelman of the Desert Sun, government bureaucracy is paralyzing their best tool for self-defense. ABC 10 quoted the Riverside County Sheriff Stan Sniff, who said that he could not speed up the permitting process without pulling deputies off patrol duties, which he was unwilling to do. Additional funding for more workers is unlikely because Sniff is embroiled in a budget battle with county leaders who worry the sheriff's department already absorbs too much money. So you, the citizens, who again are applying to exercise your constitutional right to bear arms, you're stuck, apparently, because the county locked in a budget battle with the sheriff, and the sheriff says, listen, we got diminished resources. I'm not pulling people off of the streets to conduct the research that has to be done here. David Teets formerly led the department's administrative division. He said it's been overwhelming. We have two folks who work in that department. So you got two individuals who are responsible for the concealed carry licensing in Riverside County, California. And he said after the terror attacks, they were absolutely inundated with people wanting concealed weapons permits. We received hundreds of phone calls, voicemails, emails. Likely, he said, upwards of 1,000 in the 2 weeks afterwards. Now, ABC 10 says delays have been less pronounced in San Bernardino County because Sheriff John McMahon reassigned several employees and a few volunteers to the permit processing unit. But even with the additional staffing, appointments with applicants are being scheduled as far out as September. Sheriff McMahon says 8 months is a long way for us. He said, I just can't put enough staff down there. I don't even have enough staff or workspace, to be honest with you. Now, here's the thing. This isn't just happening in the Inland Empire. This isn't just happening around San Bernardino, California. This is happening all over the country, where there are a record number of concealed carry permits that have been issued in the state of Minnesota, where we just talked with Ed Morrissey, where concealed carry applications have nearly tripled since December in the state of Oklahoma, where the concealed carry classes, 20 spots open up down in Florida, and 900 people apply. This is not a regional trend. This is not a local response to the attacks in San Bernardino. Again, this is something that is occurring from coast to coast. Now, ABC 10 quotes anti-gun activist Ari Frelick, an attorney with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. And he says the real reason why we are seeing this increase in people applying for their concealed carry licenses is inaction in Congress on gun control. He says since lawmakers haven't done anything to prevent future attacks, the public was left to conclude that the job was up to them. Because if Congress passed a bill, that would take care of everything, right? He said, instead of passing responsible, common-sense laws to keep military-grade weapons out of the hands of dangerous people, including terrorists, Congress has left civilians to join a dangerous arms race and effectively be drafted into law enforcement duty in their private lives. He says, we don't believe civilians should be compelled to make that choice. It doesn't make us safer. They don't believe civilians should have that choice. Now, let's be blunt here. They want California to remain May issue. They want sheriffs in California to be able to deny people their concealed carry permit because they want a gun for self-defense. They want a sheriff to be able to look that applicant in the eye and say, doesn't matter, no. That's what they want. And it's, I got to say, it's a bizarre argument to say that because all of these gun control advocates can't see action in Congress, all of a sudden they're going to become concealed carry holders. They're just forced into that position. You think it's likely to happen? Again, keep in mind, we're also talking right now about what's going on in the Inland Empire part of California, where they have some of the most restrictive gun laws in the state or in the country on the books already. And Ari Frelick says, no. People are angry at Congress for not passing more gun control laws, and so they're running out and they're becoming concealed carry holders. That's what's happening. It's weird because on all of the firearms instructors that we've talked to, all of the gun store owners that we've talked to over the past couple of months, not one of them has mentioned this phenomena of gun control activists coming in angry that Congress won't do anything, and so their only recourse is to become a concealed carry holder. They have not been drafted into law enforcement duty in their private lives, not according to the people that we've talked to who've been training these folks. They've enlisted. They haven't been drafted. They have enlisted themselves into their own security force, right? Their own personal security force. I will defend myself. I will defend the people that I love. Not because Congress has failed to act, but because I want to be able to protect myself. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we return here on NRA News Cam and Company, Lance Tolan of Lance Tolan Associates, we'll talk with him about why he has decided that every employee of his should be a concealed carry holder. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
All right, so we're out walking around here, and I ran into Glenn Klecker with Klecker Knives. All right, tell me, what is Klecker Knives? What are you all about?
Klecker Knives is basically about innovation, family values, good old whatever I can do to help people enjoy their time in the outdoors and bring their family doing it.
All right, and you got some really neat stuff, so show us some of your products here.
Well, the first one I want to show here is the trigger. This is basically like a knife kit. We designed a wooden one that we released before with my son Nathan.
Mm-hmm.
This is the follow-on version. The idea behind this is it's a bunch of parts you can build together like a model car or model plane.
Cool.
You put the pieces together and it's a full locking knife, but it's not sharp. It's guaranteed to cut butter though.
That's cool. What else you got?
So then the next one is, this is the Cordovan. This is our most popular folding knife. And the idea behind the Cordovan is that it has a locking system that I have a patent on. So this is called the Klecker Lock. Then over here we have a new one for this year is called the Abiqua. Comes built with a Kydex sheath. The idea behind the Abiqua is that people want really good, comfortable hunting knife. Fits good in the hand. But the benefit of the Abiqua is that it has a built-in gut hook right into the handle.
Oh, nice.
So it gives you a nice full three-finger gut hook, so you're not going to lose it. So this is called the Klax. It stands for the Klecker Axe System. The idea behind this is how can you go to the woods, have the tools you need, and not have to carry all the bulk that you would normally.
Okay.
So on a regular axe, you're going to carry around an axe that's got a handle about this size.
Right.
But with this, you carry around just this. When you need to, you can take this, use it as a hand tool, carve yourself a handle, cut a split in it, and then just flip the clamps out, slide it down over the handle, tighten it up, whack it on the log a few times, seat the clamps, and then you can start going to town.
Awesome. How can folks get more information about Klecker Knives?
So you can find us on the web at kleckerknives.com.
All right. Glenn Klecker with Klecker Knives. Save the best for last. Dennis, one. This is one for you for Dennis Rosato. There you go, buddy. Thanks for being on NRA News. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
I'm a mom. And just like millions of other women, that's why I own guns. We're responsible, we're law-abiding, and we're everything that makes America strong. Every day, we're willing to use a firearm to defend our families. But the media will never tell those stories. If a mom puts a gun to the face of a home-invading thug and makes him run for his life, the story gets buried. But if she's unarmed and murdered, the cameras will be at the scene before the police. It's time for moms like me to speak out. We are the majority. We demand the freedom to defend our families. And we challenge the media to tell the truth about our rights. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I know you're watching, so pay attention. You hate my freedom, my religion, and my country. You hate me for speaking my mind. You try to control me with violence and intimidation. You think you can muzzle me with fear? Don't ever confuse me for my politicians or my media. I am an American, free-born and free-bred, and I will call you out for who you are. An Islamic extremist who would kill me for my beliefs. You don't intimidate me. My freedom is more powerful than anything you can possibly do. And I will never, never surrender my rights to your terror. I will say what I think, worship according to my beliefs, and raise my children how I see fit. And I defend it all with the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. I cower to no one, because I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. All right, we've got some more breaking news here this afternoon. We told you about what was going on in Virginia, where the right to carry reciprocity measure signed by Governor McAuliffe. The House, U.S. House, has passed H.R. 2406, the Sportsman's Heritage and Recreational Enhancement Act, which provides enhanced access to public lands, limits punitive regulations. Hopefully we'll expand opportunities for ranges to be built so we can actually get our training at a more regular location. So this is a good thing. Passing again out of the House, H.R. 2406. And I want to welcome to the program right now from Lance Tolan Associates down in Georgia. Mr. Lance Tolan. Lance, how you doing today?
No complaints, and yourself?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. I'm guessing you've been a very busy guy this week.
Extraordinarily.
Well, this is good. This means people are paying attention here. So you own a tell me about your business. What does Lance Tolan Associates actually do?
Well, Lance Tolan Associates is a 35-plus year ongoing business. I engage in, I have an aviation insurance practice in Atlanta, Georgia. I have three offices, one at Atlanta's Peachtree DeKalb Airport in DeKalb County. I have one at my original office in my at Spalding County Airport, Griffin, Georgia, and one at St. Simon's Island down on the coast by Sea Island, and that's in Glenn County, Georgia. And if you look at all these counties, they stack up in the top 10 meanest counties in Georgia.
And so because of that, you decided that you wanted your employees to be able to protect themselves.
Well, it's a combination of location, location, location in my three offices. But actually, it's more than that. It's, again, about our rights to protect ourselves through the Second Amendment and the 14th, which really gives us equal protection in all states under the law. And people overlook that.
And so what did you tell your employees?
Well, I have a 30-year tenured employee who's an NRA instructor. She's leaving. It's always been implicit that she had a gun. I've got a gun in my desk. And the girls in the office were never uncomfortable with it. I think there was a comfort level. With Mary Brannon's departure, it left a void in our security at that particular location in Griffin. 5 miles south of that office several years ago, in an insurance agency, two women were in the office. An individual came in under the guise of asking for a charitable donation. One of the girls left for lunch while this individual was there. She returned, and her coworker, her colleague, laid on the floor dead, murdered. The guy was caught. He was tried, and he went to prison for life. And he did die in prison. I have a problem with that. My uncle, who was a World War II veteran, a decorated war hero, lied about his age on the day after Pearl Harbor. Came back to Griffin, Georgia, raised a family of three. I was orphaned in the first grade. He pulled me in and took care of me. The one day he did not have his weapon with him at his business in Griffin, Georgia, he was gunned down by three thugs for under $100.
Mm.
Yeah, I do have a problem with it.
Yeah. And what was the response when you told your employees, I want you to get your concealed carry license? In fact, did you tell them that that's my expectation? If you're not going to have a job unless you get it? How did you explain this to them?
Well, I looked at it from this perspective. We have a need there for security. I discussed it with the ladies in my office, and I said, this is mandate. I want you to do this. Would I fire any of my long-tenured employees? My employees, again, Mary Brannon, 30.5 years with me.
Wow.
Started this business at a young age. My average tenure is like 25 years. My lowest tenured lady just came in. She's been with me over a year now, and she already had a carry permit. So at the end of the day, I said, ladies, let's all just go ahead and get you guys trained up and get you some weapons. And every one of them said, you know, Lance, this is something I wanted to do. I've been meaning to do. I'm afraid. I'm afraid when I'm in my car. I'm afraid when I go home. And this prompted these ladies, these professionals, some of them are pilots, They're all very well educated and are pros at what they do. They're responsible individuals. So they all scurried out, got their permits, came back, and I presented them all with a Taurus judge. And there are so many choices of good handguns and weapons out there. This is a defensive weapon in my eyes. It's a weapon that the ladies can handle easily. It's accessible. And it's not a 357 or a 9mm that might go through multiple walls in the event of a problem where you have to make a split-second decision. But it's a weapon that, again, when a perpetrator comes in, he started a fire, and I told him it's just a point-and-pull gun. It's not an aim-and-shoot. It's just put some water on the fire. Get him out of there. We don't want to kill anybody. We just want our people to be safe. And this was embraced 100%, and they've all gone through training now, visiting the range. And I've given a number of guns to other people, the same weapon, attorneys, judges, you name it. Anybody who asks, has a concern about a weapon or their safety, I said, here's what you do. I'm going to give you this. You get some training, get your license, go out there, protect yourself. You know, we had Minutemen that put their life on the line for our freedoms. There's only one constitutional appointed law enforcement arm in our country, and it's the sheriff. And these founding fathers knew that the sheriff couldn't be anywhere, I mean everywhere at any time, and it was up to the citizenry to protect themselves. So that's why we have that right to bear arms. It doesn't say the right to bear a taser, and it doesn't say the right to bear mace. It says to bear arms. That was a definitive statement that is made in the Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment, we exercise it in my office. We're not going to have an incident like happened 5 miles where a young 25-year-old woman just starting her life was just senselessly murdered by some wacko nutcase.
Talking again with Lance Toland in the great state of Georgia. And Lance, I can actually hear our audience cheering as you're talking about this because, you know, there is so much cultural pressure, I think, right now being brought by, anti-gun activists in the media to diminish the idea of self-defense, right? You shouldn't be thinking about this. In fact, Cosmo Magazine, Marie Claire, both with big sections this month in their magazines about women owning firearms and why that's a bad idea. And yet, you know, out there in the real world, as you say, most of your employees had said this is something that I'd been thinking about already, right?
Absolutely. They all know that I have, and I've carried a gun since I was a young man.
Yeah.
Back when I was a freight pilot. I mean, gosh, you wouldn't think a freight pilot could get hijacked, but we had issues back in the 70s as young pilots flying all night and old airplanes and, you know, drugs and things like this in the Southeast. People wanting to commandeer airplanes and steal the airplane, kill you, or make you fly it somewhere. So I was always ready. And these are responsible citizens who wanted to do it. This departure and this commentary in my office was the catalyst for them to go ahead and go down and see how easy the process was to get the concealed license from the state of Georgia probate office in their county. And it's a good thing. I pray they never have to use the weapon, but if the situation rears its ugly head, at least they don't have to just say a prayer and die. They're going to have some protection.
Now, I know that I saw one news report where you said that some of your clients have talked with you about this. They think it's a great idea, and they've talked about maybe doing it with their own companies. Have you talked with other local business owners? I mean, is this idea going to spread, you think, there in Georgia?
Well, not Georgia. I actually had an insurance agency out of Arizona applaud me and said that they have several people in their office who are armed and they're making it a mandate. I had a business owner in Georgia that's in manufacturing. He said he's going to have all executive staff to go out and get their concealed weapons license. He said, Lance, this is brilliant. This is the CEO who tells me I'm brilliant, which I don't think I'm brilliant. He said, your statement made so much sense to me. We have so many job applicants that come in and they fail drug tests. We do a random diligence on their background check, they flunk it, there's some problem in their background. And it costs us $1,000 or $1,500, depending on how deep we dig. He said, but what you did is you made it abundantly clear that the state, for $65 in the state of Georgia, you've got fingerprints, you've got a photo ID that's issued after the check. And when that applicant gets that license, that carry permit, he's a law-abiding citizen. You know that right off the bat. As a job applicant, if he has that with him, you can see it's him. He's not a pedophile. He is not a felon. He is not a convicted drug user. And he has had some mental observation done at the probate office, as well as many other checks our state does. So for $65, I know coming through the door, I've got someone that we could at least spend some time on to hire or consider hiring. So again, it's just a great vehicle to do your diligence in vetting potential employees. An architect told me one time, and this is a little bit why I thought about this, is that an architect told me, he said, you know, we got so many doggone applications. He would always say, give me the ones that are a Eagle Scout. And he said the pile got really thin. And that's who they would hire. That's who they would look at, with the Eagle Scouts off the top. And so I've just taken it. I'll look at the Eagle Scouts now, and I'll also look at a carry permit. Your resume goes to the top of the pile.
Well, listen, I got to tell you, Lance, it is a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for taking a couple minutes to join us here on NRA News Cam and Company. I hope we can have you back on in the future.
Anytime. Thank you for the good work that you do in preserving our rights in this country. But a lot of people died for that right.
Absolutely. Listen, thank you again for what you do, and give our best to all the folks in the office there.
Absolutely. Bye.
Thank you, sir. Lance Tolan joins from Lance Tolan Associates on NRA News, Cam & Company, the insurance office where everyone is armed. Will Creeley of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education will join us after a quick timeout. We'll talk about the threats to free speech and free expression on our college campuses. Again, not coming from concealed carry holders, coming from student and sometimes faculty activists. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam & Company coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Mark Velarde with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and da-da-da, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years. And then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer. And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years. Yeah. What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on, she's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids and you mm-hmm. thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago, 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and Mark, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling right. our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years old. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience that he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up next hour, Brad Slager riding at the Federalist, Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day. Right now, from the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, want to welcome to the program Will Creeley. Will, how you doing, sir?
Thank you so much for having me on this Friday afternoon, Cam.
Absolutely. It is a. I was going to say it's a pleasure. We love talking to the folks at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, but it's always about the worst stories. I got to tell you, Will. I mean, really. Although I guess we did talk about the 10 worst colleges for free speech. doggone it. All right. So at the University of South Carolina, this is fascinating to me. There are a couple of students there involved with Young Americans for Liberty and the College Libertarians who held an event outdoors. Was this in the designated free speech zone, Will?
It was, Cam. They got permission to do it by the probably unconstitutional rules. That's how careful they were.
Okay, so they're there in the designated free speech zone. They've got their display here about expressions that had been censored on campuses across the country, and wouldn't you know it, Will, apparently some people were triggered. This was a microaggression. And what did the University of South Carolina do after having given permission for this display to take place?
Well, Cam, you know, I've been in this business of defending student rights for 10 years, and nothing ever surprised me. The University of South Carolina hauled in the student named Ross Abbott, a brave young student who is trying to increase awareness about censorship on other campuses. They hauled him in and told him that he had been charged with violating the USC policy and that he was going to have to answer for offending his fellow students.
Seriously?
That's right. I mean, we couldn't believe it either. You know, it's almost crazy at this point. You're getting censored for talking about censorship.
Yeah. Right? I mean, you know, and again, you're getting censored for talking about censorship by people who are proclaiming that that the University of South Carolina is a bastion of free speech and free expression.
That's right. That's right. You are facing an investigation. Ross Abbott was threatened with an investigation because his fellow students said that his display about speech that had been censored on other campuses, many of which, by the way, were cases that my organization, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, had defended, because they had said that those posters, which talked about those instances of censorship elsewhere, had triggered them and were so offensive that they could have started a riot. I mean, come on.
This is, you know, what's fascinating about this, Will, is, you know, some of this is coming from the administrators, but when you look at this story, when you look at what happened yesterday in Los Angeles, where Ben Shapiro tried to give a speech, and you had students who were, you know, blocking those doors. It was students who were trying to prevent that speech from taking place.
That's right, Cam. And frankly, that's one of the most depressing parts of the job that we now face here at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. For the decade that I've been here, most of the threats to free speech came from administrators, which is bad enough. But there's something really disheartening about seeing young adults calling for the censorship of other young adults just for speaking their minds. I mean, that's a terrible lesson to send folks before they arrive in our democracy as adults and, you know, run for office and cast their vote and all the rest of it, that when speech offends you, the answer is not to answer it, but to run to the authorities. I mean, that's just, yeah, it's depressing.
It is. And, I, you know, and you're not only having to educate the administrators, but now you're having to, frankly, do the job of the schools in many ways and educate the students about the rights that they possess. And it has to be a real challenge. And, you know, I know that this is something that Greg Lukianoff has written about, sort of how we got here.
Right.
Right? To this a point where we've got snowflakes who can't handle hearing an opposing point of view. All of a sudden, that is now something that has to be shut down. How, you know, Will, how easy is it going to be to turn this around? I mean, it seems like...
I think we've got our work cut out for us here at FIRE. You know, I think you can lay it at the feet of many factors, one of which being the fact that students arrive on campus these days without a good civics education in high school. They haven't been told what their First Amendment rights are. So for every case like Ross Abbott, who bravely stands up and speaks his mind and comes to us and wants to fight back by filing a First Amendment lawsuit, we have to figure that that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, how many students out there, when they're threatened with punishment and investigation by their school, do they just put their heads down? I mean, I can't even really blame them for it. They're trying to get a degree. You know, it takes a special student like Ross to be brave enough to stand up and fight. So we fear that the cases that do make their way to us, the cases that we're able to fight, that's just a small percentage of the type of censorship that goes on every day.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it should be noted as well that Ross Abbott filing this suit after the university, I guess, maybe tried to back down, right? When he pushed back, the university eventually said, well, never mind, we're going to drop the matter, right? We're not going to investigate this any further.
That's right. Ross went to the administrators and said a couple things. First of all, he said this is all constitutionally protected speech. He said your policies here at University of South Carolina are no good, and they empower students to silence other students in just the way that they're trying to silence me. So you should clarify your policies. And finally, you should adopt a statement put out by University of Chicago at the beginning of last year that's really kind of a beautiful articulation of the importance of free expression on the college campus called the Chicago Principles, and you can read more about it on our website, thefire.org. And he said the University of South Carolina should adopt the Chicago Principles so that students begin to understand that when they see something that's offensive to them, that's an invitation for thought and discussion and debate, not censorship. And wouldn't you know it, the University of South Carolina administrator dropped the matter, never got back to him, never clarified the policies. So that's part of the reason that Ross and the Young Americans for Liberty and the college libertarians decided to sue, because they don't want to see this happen to somebody else, and the university has refused to correct its policies.
So the suit just filed, I'm guessing the university has not responded yet, right? They've got about a month or so to do so?
Yeah, that's right. They are on notice, but we are standing by.
All right. Well, listen, Will, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Hopefully we'll be able to talk again soon. There's unfortunately no shortage of stories from around the country to talk about, but we really do appreciate the work you all are doing there on college campuses.
Never a dull moment, Cam. Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Will Creeley with us from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And, yeah, never a dull moment on college campuses these days. Brad Slager writing at the Federalist on Hollywood's hypocritical love-hate relationship with guns next hour. Also, Mr. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis. In San Francisco, the police chief has volunteered his force to use smart guns. How about that? Greg Sewer telling audiences at a smart gun symposium in San Francisco this week that San Francisco police are welcoming the chance to become the country's biggest smart gun proving site. He said our officer safety is huge, so you wouldn't want to compel that upon officers. But he says, we have so many officers who are so into technology, I am all but certain there are officers that will be willing to do such a pilot. Oh. So he didn't ask any officers. He just said, yo, we got a lot of tech guys and gals. We got people who are really into technology. I'm sure. I bet. Almost all but certain we've got people who would be willing to do this. But why wouldn't you want to mandate it? What did the chief say? Officer safety is huge, so you wouldn't want to compel that upon officers. So if the smart guns made officers safer, why wouldn't you want to compel that on officers? Seems to me like even the chief of police there in San Francisco isn't really convinced this is a great idea. Now, Inverse.com says the smart guns could only be fired by an authenticated owner. By the way, there is no gun for the officers to test, even if they want to. Let's also keep this in mind here, because Inverse.com and many of the news stories that have been written about the police chief's comments there in San Francisco don't make that clear. There is no smart gun. Even if 50 officers came to the chief today and said, okay, chief, we're ready. Where's our smart guns? The chief would say, well, I don't know. They haven't been invented yet. Because there is no firearm right now, other than a really expensive .22 caliber pistol that you have to wear a watch. And we're not going to send officers out there with .22 caliber pistols. It's not going to happen. Inverse.com says Sewer was basically preaching to the choir here. The San Francisco Smart Gun Symposium, sponsored by Smart Tech Challenges Foundation, which funds entrepreneurs in the field. Inverse says, we've reached out to the San Francisco Police Department for comment to explain how such a system would work. We will update when we hear back. Now, there was today, but so far they have not updated. Apparently they have not heard back from the San Francisco Police Department about how this would actually work. Probably because the answer, again, is not well, given that we haven't actually asked police departments or our police officers about this. There is, at this point, no actual firearm that we could test. He said, if we in law enforcement had guns that were only of use to the officer identified with the gun, that would be a good thing. He said, what if every gun that fell into the wrong hands was of no use to anybody? Like you can brick a stolen phone, why couldn't you brick a stolen firearm? Well, you know, again, if the technology is out there, if it's ever developed in such a way that it's feasible and practical, then the marketplace will probably decide. But right now, it's it's not there. So you're, again, kind of talking about something that doesn't exist. In the meantime, what's fascinating is that the city of San Francisco has recently passed an ordinance requiring all gun owners who have their firearms in their vehicles keep them locked up in a locked container within the vehicle itself, except for law enforcement. Even though we've seen several firearms stolen from law enforcement officers in the San Francisco area, and that was the reason why the city council in San Francisco passed this new ordinance, they actually exempted the law enforcement officers. So I'm kind of curious why the chief wasn't asked about this. You know, if this is something that every law-abiding gun owner in San Francisco now has to do, and you're concerned what if every gun that fell into the wrong hands was of no use to anybody? Well, why don't you have these locked containers in the law enforcement vehicles? Why does this ordinance not apply to every law enforcement officer in the Bay Area? Kind of fascinating. Again, I don't think the reporters covering the chief's comments are actually aware of that ordinance, which is sad, but I'm guessing that's the case. I'm guessing they didn't even know that they could ask the police chief about this ordinance and officer safety and firearms and technology. All right, stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Michael Faw of Crimson Trace. Michael, how are you, sir?
Good, Don. How are you today?
I am doing great. Thanks for being back here on NRA News. All right, so ran into you here. You've got a really cool new product to show us. Tell folks, what is Crimson Trace? What do you guys do?
Crimson Trace is a laser siding manufacturer out in the Portland, Oregon area. We make more than 200 laser siding systems for firearms. We also make military siding hardware.
How does Crimson Trace, give us a quick story of how Crimson Trace came about as a company.
Came up with an idea from our founder, Lou Danielson, and then that was more than 20 years ago. We've been in business that long, and the product lines have evolved since then. So it was a concept he had, and he just grew it into what today is known as Crimson Trace, the
right.
Great American story.
And I'll tell you what did you mention for me on the air? What, over 200 product lines?
Over 200 products. We have red and green laser siding systems now.
It's awesome. And I'll tell you what, Michael, when you talk to people in the industry, in shooting sports competitive, no matter what, it's one of those names, Crimson Trace is, you know, everyone knows about it. You talk about having a strong brand.
One of the reasons we have so many products, we listen to customers. We know that a lot of NRA members are current customers, and we listen to what customers ask for or suggestions, and that's where the product base grows from.
And you also mentioned something about NRA members.
Yes. All of our employees are also NRA members. We pay the membership for the ones who don't join on their own, but we're all 100% NRA.
And it's so awesome, Michael, when a manufacturer understands that we're all in this fight together.
And they enjoy also getting the magazines and their hats.
I love it. Speaking with Michael Faw, and he's the public and media relations manager for Crimson Trace. All right, so show us what you got, my friend. What is this?
Okay, this year we're known also for innovation. We've come up with a wireless system. The module is activated by the grip. So you can take your standard AR rifle grip off, and as long as your gun also has a rail somewhere on it, you can attach the module. So this grip is paired with that sight. So it's a laser and a light. So you can activate it this, and it's... There's more than 256 different signatures and codes that those two pieces of equipment communicate with, so there's no hacking it or no problems or anything else. So it's a wireless system designed by Crimson Trace.
Laser and a light and a wireless system, pretty cool stuff. So tell folks what's the advantage of having a system like this?
It leaves you've got one hand that's control of your firearm. You've got the other hand that's free. You don't have to keep reaching up. You don't have to worry about wires. You don't have to worry about cables or anything else that's getting snagged on anything if you're moving through either the brush or a building or anything. So we know that this has hunting applications for people who are pursuing pigs and coyotes. And then it also has home defense applications. And we are growing the number of modules and the options that will be available, but it will all be controlled by the grip, the pistol grip.
It has applications here with the NRA News Crew. As soon as you broke it out, we're showing to everyone, just about everybody here wants to get one.
Folks are lined up at the booth also looking at it. And yesterday at the range we had an event, and people were lined up and just, you know, let me see this. We've heard all about it.
Let me see it. Let me have one.
Yeah, let me have one is the big request.
Michael Fall with Crimson Trace. How can folks get more information about Crimson Trace?
Obviously, crimsontrace.com is the fastest way to get information. And then we also have more than 2,500 dealers across the U.S. So most gun ranges and gun shops sell our products. They can go in there and look at a catalog, or they can call 800-442-2406 and request a catalog. We'll send a free one. The website's also a store. They can buy stuff there. We know that all dealers don't necessarily stock all right. 200 products.
Michael, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Brad Slager, writing at the Federalist on Hollywood's hypocritical love-hate relationship with firearms, and Mr. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News, who will join us a little bit later on in the program. Right now, let's get to our Hero of the Day, our Deal of the Day, our Good Guy of the Day. Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, an update on an armed citizen story we told you about earlier in the week. In the Twin Cities area, Minneapolis Star Tribune reporting that the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office has identified the would-be robber who was fatally shot on Monday in St. Paul, excuse me, in Brooklyn Park, by a would-be robbery victim who is a concealed carry holder. 20-year-old Armaj Craig of Minneapolis was killed after trying to rob that concealed carry holder. The name of the robbery victim has not been released. Police say the two men exchanged gunfire about 8 o'clock Monday night there in Brooklyn Park. Officers arrived at the scene and found Armaj Craig, who was attempting a robbery, on the ground. Deputy Police Chief Mark Brule said the person targeted in the robbery has a valid permit to carry a handgun and was not arrested. Brule said the robbery suspect who died, quote, goes back and forth between Brooklyn Park and Minneapolis. He's an individual we have known from previous contact. He certainly hangs out around here. Star Tribune reports that the 20-year-old had convictions for carrying a pistol without a permit as well as theft in the state of Minnesota. And those are the convictions, by the way. Star Tribune says as of early this year, there are more than 221,000 active gun permit holders in Minnesota. The total has grown by more than 20,000 in the past 6 months. Star Tribune says there have been several instances during the past few years of suspects being shot in the act of committing a crime by people who had concealed carry permits, including last August when 16-year-old Levante Broadbent shot to death on a St. Paul River bluff when he tried to rob a man who had a concealed carry license as well. But now, again, authorities releasing the name of that robbery suspect who was killed earlier this week by the armed citizen defending himself there in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. Our deal of the day. From Redding.com in Redding, California. The story of a Redding man who is already wanted on rape charges, now facing accusations of assaulting another woman. 46-year-old Redding man sought for investigation of rape, stalking, and domestic violence. Is accused of raping a 40-year-old woman in January at a Redding motel. Is also accused of assaulting, threatening, and stalking a second woman. The record searchlight in Redding, California says police have been looking for Ronald Price Jared after he failed Tuesday to appear in Shasta County Superior Court, where he was scheduled to be arraigned on 8 felony counts, including rape, assault, corporal injury, and stalking. According to the police report, Jared and the woman he allegedly raped have known each other for years, began arguing January 24th over money and his recent relationships with other women. As the argument continued, she told police Jared snapped, punched her in the stomach, continued to physically assault her by striking her on the left side of the head. He then sexually assaulted her as she pleaded for him to stop, adding that he recorded some sort of some of the sexual assault on his iPad. A few days later, the police report said the woman called police to report that Jared had assaulted her at her residence, took her car without permission, and refused to return it. As a police officer was interviewing her at her workplace about what had happened, he drove by, the suspect did, in her car and called her on her cell phone, yelling at her, demanding to know who she was speaking with. The officer quickly followed after Jared conducted a traffic stop. According to the police report, he became uncooperative, refused to comply with commands, made furtive movements like he was reaching for a weapon. Officer said Jared told him, quote, go ahead and shoot me. He was subsequently taken into custody. As investigators were gathering information about the case, the Record Searchlight says, officers learned of another woman who claimed that Jared had assaulted her and has been harassing and stalking her, a 41-year-old woman who told police that she met Jared in 2014, said he became controlling and violent, describing that she was initially assaulted by him in May or June of 2015. She said she never reported the incident because she was afraid. Record Searchlight says Jared has a lengthy Shasta County criminal history that includes a variety of felony and misdemeanor charges. Last year, pleaded no contest to misdemeanor sexual battery and felony vandalism. What do you bet? I don't have the charging documents in front of me, but what do you bet that this man was not originally charged with misdemeanor sexual battery, but was in fact charged with a felony sexual offense? What do you think the chances are? I'm thinking they're pretty good. And instead, he was allowed to plead no contest to reduce charges, and he was placed not in the custody of the California Department of Corrections. He was placed on probation. But the Record Searchlight says that probation has since been revoked. Well, that's good to know. Of course, he's still on the loose because apparently he was able to post bond after, again, being arrested on 8 different felony counts, because otherwise he would have shown up in court because he would have been in jail. But keep in mind, in California right now, the criminal justice system is a mess. Like many other things in California right now, it is a absolute mess. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court said California's prisons were overcrowded. California did not want to spend the money to build new prisons. So instead, voters in a referendum passed a law that made it easier for nonviolent offenders to be released from prison early. Other nonviolent offenders were moved from prison to county jails, where they would then serve out most of their sentence and then be eligible for early release. Again, they're supposed to be nonviolent offenders. But the problem is, you can have a violent criminal history as long as the charge that you're serving right now, as long as the conviction that you're serving right now is for a nonviolent offense, you're a nonviolent offender. It doesn't matter what your previous criminal history shows. So you've got this ripple effect throughout the criminal justice system in California. Fewer people in prison. People who used to be in prison now in the county jails, serving out their sentence, which means that the county jails now have fewer spaces available for people like Ronald Price Jared, who faces almost a dozen felony charges, but they may have to offer someone like that bond, even though they would prefer to keep them behind bars because they don't have the space to do so anymore. And so somebody like Ronald Price Jared, able to bond out, and able to skip out on his court date. But, you know, his probation has been revoked, so at least we've got that going for us. Ronald Price Jared there in Shasta County, California, our deal of the day today. And our good guy from Fox 4 News, the story of a police officer. It's another one of those pictures that is gone viral in Frisco, Texas. Photograph of a Frisco police officer helping a homeless vet found along the side of the Dallas North Tollway has gone viral online. Picture was taken Tuesday night after the officer took the man to get a hotel room, used his own money to pay for the homeless vet. The picture shows the police officer and the homeless veteran standing there at the check-in counter of the hotel. Can't see either of their faces, but you can see the word police across the officer's jacket there. A welfare check on the man sitting on the side of the Dallas Parkway brought Frisco police officer Brandon Ferrant to the busy stretch of road on Tuesday night. When the officer arrived on scene, Fox 4 says he didn't find a guy sitting out by the frontage road. Instead, he found him several yards away, holding onto a barbed wire fence. Officer Ferrati said the man looked exhausted. He said, I mean, he was soaked to the bone. And as I talked to him, he tells me a story that he's trying to walk to Denton, Texas. Now, I don't know if you know Texas, but Denton is on the north, it's north of Dallas. Frisco is south of Dallas. That's a heck of a walk. Officer Ferrani found out the man was a homeless veteran who once served as a combat engineer. And Ferrani, whose dad was in the Air Force, said he felt compelled to help. He said, at that point, I said, we need to take care of this guy. And we need to take care of him now. He said, there's no way I'm going to let him walk to Denton. So he got the man a room at a nearby Comfort Suites while paying for the room with his own money. Fox 4 says Ferrani's partner snapped a photograph of the moment. Officer Ferrani expressing a point of view that we have heard from other law enforcement officers who have been highlighted as our good guys. Brandon Ferrani says it's not just about putting people in jail, it's about helping them out. And again, I think that that is an attitude that most law enforcement officers have, but it is an attitude that is rarely highlighted by the media. You know, the job of a law enforcement officer is to protect and to serve the community. Sometimes protecting the community means charging into a building where a violent criminal is inside trying to take out as many innocent lives as possible. And you have to be that first responder on the scene. Sometimes protecting and serving the community, again, involves being in the right place at the right time and doing the right thing. Something that is not expected of you, not according to your duties, but something that, again, you feel like you're responsible for as a human being. So, Officer Brandon Ferrati, we thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. I mentioned we're going to be talking with Brad Slager of the Federalist, coming up in just a little bit about Hollywood's hypocritical love-hate relationship with firearms. It is Oscar weekend. You know, one of the, I don't know if... this movie's up for an Oscar, but there was a movie about the Mexican drug cartels that came out this year. Looked fairly compelling. Haven't seen it, but that's because, again, 90% of the stuff that I watch is animated and with my kids. But the Global Post has an article. James Frederick published this today. Mexico's gun dealers are unfazed by Obama. Quote, we'll just open another channel. It is a look at the illegal gun ownership across Mexico, where it is not just cartel members, but members of law enforcement, state security, who are a part of the illicit arms trade. And where you have a number of Mexican citizens who are restricted from owning firearms. The government makes it very, very difficult for Mexican citizens to legally own a firearm. You have to go to the one gun store in the country, which is located there in Mexico City, where you can acquire your 22 caliber rifle or your 38 caliber revolver. Registered with the nation's defense department, as the Global Post reports, carrying a gun outside of your property or beyond hunting areas, however, is very restricted. And yet that doesn't seem to have much of an impact on the cartels, does it? The Global Post said, when polled by the high rate of violence, three-quarters of Mexicans say they still wouldn't want to own a gun for protection. But one in four would. For those who do want to purchase one legally, the only gun stores in Mexico City is run by the Army, the Global Post says. But illegal gun dealer Javier says, quote, most people don't want to do that. It's faster and cheaper to get it from us, especially if you don't want the gun traced back to you. Global Post says the Army, the only agency that tracks guns in Mexico. The Army responded to a request on legal gun ownership with the current numbers. Ready for this? About 3,000 valid licenses for individual gun owners across the entirety of Mexico. Sure, on paper, you can own a gun in Mexico. On paper, you have a right to bear arms in Mexico. In reality, you don't. In reality, the Army says, we've got about 3,000 valid licenses for gun owners across the entire country. The Army said it doesn't track trends over time because it is, quote, not necessary for the performance of our duties. Uh-huh. Now, what's fascinating is that Javier, the illegal gun distributor, quoted in the story by the Global Post, says that soldiers and cops are some of his suppliers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's getting some of the guns that he's selling on the black market from law enforcement and from the military. He said, say they recover 20 guns at a crime scene. They'll record 10 as confiscated and sell the other 10 to us. His business partner, who says he's an ex-soldier, confirms the practice. And the Global Post says, granted, we couldn't verify the arms dealer suppliers. If Javier and his associates are telling the truth, it is anecdotal. But they say, while many Mexican law enforcement agents have been suspected of illicit rackets, the government does not offer evidence to confirm or deny officials participating in gun rings. And when asked, the Army says that no soldiers have been sanctioned for the misappropriation or trafficking of weapons. Now, the Global Post says there may be a few reasons to be hopeful. Straw purchasers in the U.S. Southwest could fall under more scrutiny, they write, with Obama's recent executive action. The multiple sales reporting requirement, the Global Post says, has been an effective tool for identifying traffickers and has led to prosecutions. But asked if he's worried, Javier, the guy who's illegally selling guns in Mexico, says, no, he's not worried. Quote, new restrictions wouldn't bother us. Says, this is Mexico. If they close one channel, we'll just open up another. New restrictions wouldn't bother us. Do what you want. We're already breaking the law. You know, again, it is worth considering how the cartels operate and what the cartels have done. It used to be 10, 15 years ago, the cartel's main product, marijuana, cocaine. Cartels weren't really involved in the meth trade. Most of that was homegrown, local here in the United States. And in order to cut down on the meth manufacturing, what do? Made it harder to get Sudafed, right? You'll hear gun control advocates, they'll complain about this. It's harder to get Sudafed than it is to get a gun in this country. That's the argument anyway. But they never talk about the result of that action. So we made it harder for you to get Sudafed or any sort of medicine with pseudoephedrine in it. You got to write your name down. you're registered to have purchased this Sudafed. Did that dry up the supply of meth in this country? No, not at all, as a matter of fact. It did maybe make it harder for the meth heads to cook their own meth and blow up their motel rooms and their homes. But it also provided an opportunity for the cartels. It's another revenue stream for the cartels. They started making meth. And they figured out a way. They're making meth on scale, right? This isn't some little small operation. Oh, no, 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 no. They're buying the materials in bulk. As a result, the cost of methamphetamine in the United States has gone down. The availability has gone up. This is the what's called the law of unintended consequences. And again, the cartels, those who are dealing in illegal guns in Mexico, not worried about another gun control law here. They don't care what the gun control laws are. We're talking about a multinational, multi-billion-dollar criminal enterprise. But an article worth reading, again, in the Global Post on the reality of Mexico's tough gun control laws and the inability of those laws to impact the cartels one iota. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Brad Slager at the Federalist, Tony Katz, join us later in the hour as well. Stick around. We'll be right back with much more. NRA News, Cam and Company, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors. Welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball. I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you, when people do this, and out of necessity what's born this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day. Right now, the numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
Speaking with Marianne Johnson with the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. Marianne, welcome back to NRA News. Tell folks, what is the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program?
So the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program is a firearm accident prevention education program for pre-K to fourth grade. It's all centered around Eddie's message, if you see a gun, stop, don't touch, run away, tell a grown-up.
Why does NRA do this?
We do it as a way to keep kids safe, get kids thinking about guns. We understand that 47% of American households have firearms in them, so kids need to know what to do when they see them.
And it kind of follows along with the NRA's bedrock message of gun safety and how important it is.
Absolutely, and that's why we do what we can and try to prevent as many accidents as possible.
And how does the NRA do it? How does the program work?
So the program, we work mostly with schools, law enforcement, libraries, healthcare providers, and daycares. We provide them with all of the materials that they need to run the program, including instructor guides, animated DVD, workbook stickers, and parents' guides for the kids to take home. So it's very easy to use, very accessible, and we're also able to offer all the material for free thanks to grant funding from the Friends of the NRA.
And there's that cool costume you might be able to get to bring to your school, right?
Absolutely, yes. We do have the mascot costume, which we're currently in the process of updating to go along with our new look that we have. And law enforcement agencies across the country all have costumes and add a whole new element to the presentation. We have a brand new website just for kids. It's eddieeagle.com. It has the video on it, has the Eddie Eagle challenge that kids can take, as well as coloring pages and some sing-along songs as well.
And Marin, how do people get more information about the program?
The best way is either you can look us up online, eddieeagle.nra.org, or you can send us an email at eddie@nrahq.org.
Marian Johnson, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Welcome back to your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is NRA News, Cam and Company. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News, still to come. Right now, I want to welcome from the Federalist, Brad Slager, is with us. Brad, how you doing, sir?
We're doing very well, Cam. How about yourself?
I am excellent, and I enjoyed your column on Hollywood's hypocritical love-hate relationship with firearms. This is something that we highlight on occasion here on this program, but as you pointed out, it is the Hollywood Awards season, and recently... I know we're talking about the Oscars this weekend, but you point out at the recent Golden Globes, there was this, as you describe it, a hilarious counterpoint to the anti-gun proselytizing that we see from Hollywood, right? Can you describe what happened here?
Yeah, it was it's one of those moments where if you watch Hollywood with any regularity, I'm attuned to a lot of the contradictions going on there, and for the last 6 months or so, Amy Schumer, of course, has been a huge anti-gun advocate with her relative Chuck Schumer, of course. But she did a presentation with Jennifer Lawrence, her supposed new best friend there in Hollywood, and she introduced a clip from Lawrence's film called Joy. And here's the gun advocate introducing the piece, and they proceeded right there in prime time to show Jennifer Lawrence firing a weapon on screen. And I just, myself bust out laughing at this contradiction. And it's the kind of thing where in Hollywood, I'm sure it probably didn't even occur to them that this was a contradiction.
Well, and I think that's the issue, Brad, is that they, some of them don't see it as a contradiction. And others, I think, who do see it as a contradiction are happy to ignore this, right? So Harvey Weinstein a few years ago, after the murders at Sandy Hook Elementary, said, I'm done making violent movies. I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm going to make an anti-NRA movie. It's going to star Meryl Streep. He had a name for it. It was called The Senator's Wife. Well, Brad, we haven't seen that movie come out yet, but Miramax did release Hateful Eight not long ago, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I even, just for the sake of accuracy, did research into this proposed movie of his. It has never moved anything past, he gave these two interviews, one with Piers Morgan, promising and swearing he would, never make violent movies again, and he was going to take down the NRA. It's never progressed past that. There's no script, no pre-production, nothing has taken place. And even last month, following The Hateful Eight, he releases Jane's Got a Gun with violent gun imagery in the content and the poster, completely bypassing his pledge to, do all these things and avoid violent content.
Yeah. So, we get to this point where Hollywood says, like this weekend, Hollywood's going to be about the art, right? And we're going to be rewarding directors and producers and actors for their incredible artistry. And art is supposed to move us. Art is supposed to have an impact on us. But then when it comes to the violence in these movies or television shows, Brad, all of a sudden, it's not art at all. It's entertainment. It is sheer entertainment. It is not going to have any sort of impact on you. It just, you just in one eye and out the other, I suppose, right?
Well, yeah, and then they also have the excuse where if you do hold them accountable in such a way, they'll say, well, we're just holding up a mirror. We're reflecting society. And then this somehow excuses their behavior. And, the main concept I pointed out in the article is the NRA is always accused of fostering this violent gun culture. but Hollywood's in the business of producing culture. That's what they do. And they start from scratch. They from whole cloth, create violent imagery, produce it, and they sell it, and they do it for profit. And these are all the things they supposedly demonize, and yet when you look at their actions, it's completely in the opposite direction. They love guns. They love making money off of guns, and they create a violent culture themselves.
So I guess this is the perhaps billion-dollar question, right? Does Hollywood create a culture of violence, or as you say, or as they would say, are they just mirroring this? Now, it's interesting to know that, you know, in reality, Brad, violent crime is at 40-year lows in this country. But I wonder...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Those stats are out there. But and again, too, I'm not the one saying Hollywood is creating this violent culture.
Right.
Those are their words. Understand it. That's their argument that they, you know, when they're on talk shows or in the media, they're the ones decrying a violent culture. But then just look at their actions. They produce culture. They produce this violent culture that they supposedly demean and demonize. So, you know, again, I'm not suggesting they're leading to violence and inspiring violence. I'm saying look at their words and look at their actions, and you're on polar opposites of the scale.
Absolutely. And you say, you know, all of this could be dismissed simply as hypocrisy, but you say in yet one more area Hollywood is guilty of the charges that they assign. Harvey Weinstein, a massive campaign bundler for President Obama's reelection bid. Numerous celebrities have backed Hillary's bid this year, as well as more slowly coming out in favor of Sanders. You say stars and studios frequently been the ear of D.C. politicians, and one of the issues that they wail about is the lobbying power of the NRA, even while they are oblivious about their own power.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a new phenomenon that I was touching on there, where it used to be, you know, let's say an actress would come out against guns, and you could go through her filmography and say, oh, 8 years ago, you appeared in this movie. Well, they would have, you know, a little bit of an escape clause there. Well, I've changed my mind since. But the new phenomenon in the last couple of years is like with Weinstein, with Liam Neeson decrying the Second Amendment and Sean Penn getting rid of his guns. They make these bold statements, but then after the fact, they produce more gun imagery. That's where it steps beyond hypocrisy, and there's a blatant blind spot and double standard going on here.
Absolutely. Well, and I'm sure it'll be on full display this weekend. We're also, Brad, you know, we will have a lot of Hollywood celebrities who are anti-gun being protected by good guys with guns, right?
Well, exactly. You know, and then the article, I should say, I'm sorry, the interview that Harvey Weinstein gave, he was saying, you know, there's no need for guns in America. There's absolutely no need for them. And then he leaves the studio with armed security. So clearly there's a need for him, but I guess general public, there's not this same need.
Yeah, well, it's cute to have that line of thinking, but again, there are millions of movie-going Americans who I think would disagree. They're happy to have their right to keep and bear arms. They don't want to see it go away. Brad, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. It's a pleasure talking with you today, sir.
Absolutely, absolutely. Enjoyed being on, and very pleased to be on with you. Thanks
absolutely.
A lot, Cam.
Hope we can do this again. Brad Slager, writing at The Federalist, again, on Hollywood's hypocritical love-hate relationship with firearms. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News, still to come on the program. If you have missed any of the show today, we have had in Virginia Governor McAuliffe signing the reciprocity bill. This will restore reciprocity with all of these states that Virginia had lost reciprocity with after Attorney General Mark Herring made his move to rid the state of reciprocity agreements with, 25 of the 30 states that Virginia recognized. Well, the gun owners across the state of Virginia spoke out. Governor McAuliffe, again, signing today a bill that will not only restore reciprocity agreements with those 25 states, but will, in fact, instruct the Virginia State Police to enter into reciprocal agreements with other states where needed. In other words, as many reciprocity agreements as we can possibly have. We want to have, in essence, universal reciprocity here in the state of Virginia. Chris Cox, NRA ILA Executive Director, says concealed carry permit holders are among the safest groups of citizens in Virginia and throughout the country. On behalf of the NRA's more than 5 million members, we commend this effort to protect public safety and fundamental freedoms, and hopefully, Chris Cox said, this effort will encourage Congress to pass national right to carry reciprocity legislation as soon as possible. NRA ILA also points out to Governor McAuliffe signing the legislation today, quote, despite a repeated onslaught of attacks from New York City billionaire Michael Bloomberg and his misguided gun control allies, yes, Michael Bloomberg and the anti-gun groups, very, very unhappy about this. But they can be very unhappy about this. There were also many more gun owners, many more Virginians who vote, who were also upset and unhappy that reciprocity with states like North Carolina, West Virginia, Pennsylvania had all of a sudden gone away. And so those gun owners who spoke up and spoke out, and by the way, not just Virginia gun owners too, but we had people from outside of the state saying, listen, I'm not going to be able to travel into Virginia now. This is going to impact you. This is my money that I will not be able to spend in the state of Virginia because I'll be spending it in North Carolina. I'll stay in West Virginia. I'll stay in Pennsylvania. I'll stay home. I won't go to your state to shop. Won't go across into Virginia to buy my kids back to school clothes. Not going to do any of that stuff. And again, because you spoke out, the bad decision by Virginia's Attorney General has been rescinded by the legislature and the governor. As a matter of fact, now again, we are going to see an expansion of the right to carry and the recognition of the right to carry here in the Old Dominion. All right, Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, going to join us. Stick around. We will be right back with much more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this. Here at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we're here with Adam Whitehead from the Sportsman's Box. Adam, thank you, sir, for coming on the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is a really cool idea. My kids, my youngest are 10, and last year for their birthday, we got them this thing called Loot Crate, which is a subscription box. And I started thinking, man, I want something like that, but I want it for me. Like, I'm not interested in comic book stuff, things like that. And my eyes just lit up when I walked by your booth because that's exactly what the Sportsman Box is, right?
Right. So it's like it's a Christmas present for any sportsman in your life or sportswoman in your life that, or for yourself, you know, that you can get every month. It's like Christmas every month.
That is awesome. So this is the January box that you've brought with you, right?
Correct. This is our January box. It just went out to our members all over the nation. We shipped all 50 states and Canada. So
this is representative of like what you'll get every month, right?
Correct. We try to make sure we do have 20 other field operatives throughout the nation. So they help us select gear to make sure that all the gear that we put in the box can be used by sportsmen all over the nation instead of just one specific general region.
How cool. So how did you guys come up with this idea?
Yeah, so I used to be in web design and kind of followed the whole tech industry and what's popular and saw that, Loot Crate was doing it. I saw them doing it and said, you know what, is anybody doing this for us, for me, because I'm a hunter and fisher myself? And I didn't see anyone doing it. And so I just kind of came up with the idea, built the website, and went to my business partner. His name is Will, and pitched the idea to him, and he jumped on board, and we've been full steam ahead ever since, so it's been a lot of fun.
I mean, and you guys have really taken off. April of 2015 was when you guys started this, right?
Correct, and we were only shipping to 48 states, and then we just had demand out of those other two states, Hawaii and Alaska, that we could make it happen. So
that is awesome. So you've been shipping since July of last year?
July of last year, yep.
Okay, and so kind of walk me through the box. I mean, what are some of the things that you guys have in the January box, for instance?
Yeah, so the January box is more of a classic box. We just kind of we put in the Stanley Thermos. Keeps your coffee hot, drinks cold. It's one-hand use. It's easy to throw in your hunting pack, and it's not going to leak unless you're pressing this button here.
Okay.
So Stanley comes out with some great products. They've been around since 1913, and they have lifetime warranty on all their products. So great item for any sportsman to have, obviously. The Outdoor Edge knife, another great tool. Great for skinning. you know, everybody could use another knife. It's got comes with a camouflage sheath, yet the knife is orange, so if it falls in the woods, you can find it easy. We have some Gear Aid Aqua Seal, which is some repair adhesive. If you get a cut in your boot, tear in your boot, put this over it, let it dry, becomes waterproof again.
Oh, nice.
Stuff like that. And the Tenacious Tape is a type of tape that you want to keep in your hunting pack. A lot of people don't know about this, but say if you get a cut in your coat while you're out in the field and you need a quick fix, throw this tape over it, makes it back windproof, waterproof, or whatever it was. And then, you know, something we like to do is, as sportsmen, we like to eat. I like to eat.
Right.
And so we always
like to eat too, Adam.
So we always want to put it like a field snack in there so they can enjoy while they're kind of going through their box. This month, this January month was, Pork Clouds by Bacon's Hair. So it's pretty much just a, fried pork skin, but a lot better recipe than kind of what you find at the normal grocery store.
That's cool. So this is, again, representative of what you're going to get every month, but
correct,
you're going to get different things every month. So how do you find the items that you're going to put in your box each and every month?
Yeah, so we always cater towards the season ahead. So, and like I said, we use 20 other sportsmen around the nation in Canada to make sure that the items can be used by everyone. But we test gear. Companies will send us gear to test. We send it out to our field operatives and such. But you can expect anywhere from $65 to $75 worth of gear.
Okay, so the longer you get a membership, the cheaper the box becomes, right?
Correct. If you pay for 12 months up front, you're going to pay $35 a month, but you will pay for that up front as well.
Okay. This is awesome. So how can folks get you online?
You can just go to thesportsmansbox.com. I mean, it is really caught on. If you check us out on social media as well, at Sportsman's Box on Instagram, www.facebook.com/sportsmansbox. You'll see people posting pictures of their boxes, getting involved with it. It's just a lot of fun to kind of come home, see that sportsman's box sitting at your doorstep, say after a long hard day of work, and you know you're about to get a Christmas present, and it's going to be geared towards your lifestyle. It's not going to be socks or anything in it. So it's a great gift option, you know.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Want to welcome to the program right now the host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, the man who he hosts a morning show, but he always gets us ready for the weekend here, Mr. Tony Katz. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. What's going on?
Well, you know, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. I am curious, though, is this the last media appearance that you do before you start your weekend?
Well, I do some other errant shows, but most of them involve the dancing arts.
They involve the what?
The dancing arts.
The dancing arts.
I think I've said enough, and I don't believe I should say any more.
Huh. All right, we'll have to talk more about this.
Listen, I'm a man of culture, Cam.
Of course.
All right. This whole idea that people who are conservatives or on the right or have some kind of decency and morality or somehow believe in the Constitution or don't believe in taking other people's money and giving it to somebody else. There's a belief that they're all fuddy-duddies and sticks in the mud. And I say fat to that, Cam. I say fat and I give it a puh-puh. I believe in the dancing arts style. And you know what? I may share with you some of my epic routines.
Wow. I would eagerly look forward to this. Are you going to be at CPAC, by the way, next week?
I'm sorry. I was talking about the other thing. Yes, I will be attending CPAC. We will be broadcasting live the morning show Thursday and Friday of next week. We'll also be doing some other broadcasting throughout the weekend. I'm very much looking forward to it. Not for any speaker. I don't care if Rubio speaks or not. I'm not interested in whatever it is Trump is going to say, although I can't imagine Trump actually shows up now and speaks, because when you're Donald Trump and you're endorsed by Chris Christie, the American Conservative Union is probably not the place for you. And by the way, that's not a Trump knock. Listen, I'm a very clear person on this subject. If Trump's the nominee, Trump's the nominee. I think there are a million things that can be happening between now and then.
I'm not angry with the guy. He doesn't upset me. It's just that I won't listen to anybody telling me he's a conservative. He's not a conservative. It's okay in that he doesn't have to be a conservative. People will vote accordingly and as they see fit. But you can't tell me he's something that he isn't. He's not a conservative. Is he a populist? Yes. Does he have two or three subjects that he considers his only subjects? Yes. Has he captured the spirit of America? Yes, and there are some reasons why that's happened. You just can't tell me he's a conservative. That's why I say I don't know why he's going to show up at the American Conservative Union. I'm going there to see the people because I want to know people who are actually conservative. I want to know if they're close to taking their own life yet.
You think that is this a movement that is in disarray? Are you worried that we've got people who are ready to give up?
I'm not. I'm never like that, and I'm not about to be like that. And if we're being completely honest with each other,
No, we have you on here so you can be dishonest every week. Yeah, of course,
well,
be honest.
Listen. When you have Kurt Switzer on, I get that. I don't think the movement is in disarray, and I don't think that Trump as the nominee is the end of anything. Why? Because I'm still here. This is how I know it. Will things be different, or could things be different, or could things be this or that? Absolutely. The end? Are everyone at National Review who, while I have no issue with them on an individual basis or as a group of people being opposed to Trump, I always thought that the dump that they did, the issue that they did, was misplaced and misguided. Do they cease to exist? Of course they don't cease to exist. Why should they cease to exist? What we're seeing is something that's unique and interesting, but is not particularly a conservative movement. So why would those who are conservative somehow feel that it's the end if something that isn't conservative is popular? I just don't know why I would think, oh, the end is nigh. I just don't feel that way.
Well, and you had, correct me if I'm wrong, you had Glenn Reynolds on your program this week, right?
The Instapundit, yeah. I had him on today, a great article out of USA Today that he wrote about called The Trump Wave, where he makes a very interesting connection to what's going on in the United Kingdom right now, in Britain, with the possible, with the, what they're calling the Brexit, right, which is the possible exit of Britain from the European Union, which is something I'm in favor of. The European Union is a joke. It has always been a joke. It has been an absolute failure. It doesn't work. It has hurt European nations. It has hurt a lot of these individual countries. And as a currency, the less the euro is around, the better it is for the dollar, as I see it. But what happened is that those of the working class got behind the Brexit first, and hard, and aggressive, and loud. And then people like Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, who, as Glenn points out extremely well, is a guy of the high society set, a cultural elitist if there ever was one in London, is also in favor of the Brexit. Well, his theory is that when you have the working class getting in favor of something and moving something, it gives cover or gives opportunity for those in positions to possibly lose real dollars, the real stature, status, et cetera, it gives them cover to be in favor of it too. And his point is that Bret Easton Ellis, the author, recently put out on Twitter that he was at a dinner in Hollywood, and he was amazed to hear all the people at the dinner who were going to vote for Trump. So his point is that while you've seen this groundswell of people from a more working-class, blue-collar kind of set, if now there are some Hollywood hoity-toities out there who are thinking about Trump, maybe we've just begun to scratch the surface. It's not that he has a cap at 30%, which now had to be moved to 46.5% because of Nevada. Maybe the cap for Trump is endless.
It very well could be. What I have found interesting is, and what I think is not really interesting, what I have found tiresome, Tony, are the number of think pieces, and I don't think you're among them. In fact, I think Glenn's piece was very, very thoughtful. What I'm tired of seeing are the pieces who say, well, if you don't agree with my candidate, you're stupid. And here's the thing. I mean, there are, it's one thing to see a tweet from, you know, somebody saying that, but it's another thing when you have paid professionals who get, you know, that's their job, is to give their analysis and their opinion. And it basically boils down to, well, if you're right, then that makes me wrong, and I can't be wrong about the American electorate, so it must be that you're stupid.
Are you referring to the pundits? Are you referring to radio hosts? Are you referring to television hosts? What are you referring to when you say this?
More pundits, I think, because I don't get a chance to listen to a lot of radio from around the country.
Well, sometimes they're one and the same, right?
Yeah, I suppose. But I guess I mean, seeing more of the written opinion pieces.
There's one thing for the people who write. They need something to write about, and that's what they choose to write about, whether they're passionate about it, believe it, or think it'll just, you know, get more clicks, you know, whatever the case may be. That's why they do it. Me, I'm not a guy who has endorsed, mainly because I want to have, for the people who listen to my show and listen to me and trust my opinion, I want you to know that I'm giving what is the opinion of what's going on right now. You take a look at the debate last night, and by the way, if you didn't like the debate, if you thought it was nasty, if you thought it was too rough, if you thought it was too clown show, don't you blame Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or Donald Trump. Don't really blame Wolf Blitzer, even though he's horrible, and don't blame that Telemundo anchor, even though she's maybe one of the worst people around. Blame Reince Priebus. Blame the GOP for allowing CNN to put those people on a stage. There's your problem. There's the issue. We see it time and again and again. A whole series of questions to Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz about whether or not you're actually Latino, and then they come back to her for a whole new round of questions about whether or not they're actually Latino. But Ted Cruz answered it right, and so did Marco Rubio at different stages. They believe that you can't be Latino unless you're a member of the left, which, I mean, I talk about this constantly, and I'm so glad to hear those guys talk about those issues. But that's why it was a clown show last night. Me, I don't so much mind it, because this was the necessary debate. You had to know whether or not Cruz or Rubio has the ability to punch back. Was it too little? Was it too late? Is the die already cast? Well, I don't believe in inevitability, because if I did, Jeb Bush would be the nominee right now. So anything is possible going into Super Tuesday. But I didn't so mind the debate last night. But if you did, remember that it's Reince Priebus' fault and the GOP's fault.
I didn't watch the entire debate last night. I did watch a little bit of it, and I had skipped the last few. I honestly, I didn't mind it. And it may just be that at this point, you know, Tony, kind of, I guess kind of like you, you know, I want to serve my audience, and frankly, you know, my opinion about who I'm voting for, and I'll be honest with you, I haven't made up my mind. March 1st is our primary. I don't know who I'll be voting for, but frankly, it's not important who I'm voting for. What I'm much more interested in is what's actually taking place in our politics and in this election season, because we have so much coverage that's sort of devoted to the silly stuff. That, you know, I think it's important that people like you and me and the writers, the commentators, spend a little bit of time actually focusing on the stuff that isn't the narrative of the day.
I thought
Glenn Reynolds did a great job with that piece, and that's why I was glad to see that you had him on, because I think that got, again, beyond the silly stuff.
Right. So I don't have a candidate. I have standards and values that I think are worth addressing and worth pushing. And you know Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty. You have him on the show at times. I had him on this week, and he said something. He quoted, he was paraphrasing Phil Kirpin of a group called American Commitment, and I thought the paraphrase was good. It's something that I've said, but I thought this was a better way to say it. I'm not mad or angry about Trump, even though Trump's not a conservative, because with Trump, and I'm paraphrasing Kirpin here, you have a 50-50 chance on every issue to have it go your way, right? With Hillary, like, there's this article. Who wrote the article from Federalist that says they're voting for Hillary instead of Donald Trump?
Oh, I don't know.
Was it Tom Nichols or something like that? Honestly, Ben Dominic, it's time to start firing people, man. Don't jump the shark when you're just getting started, kid. That's bad. Bad, bad career move right there. Take some advice. Don't be that guy. With Donald, you got a 50-50 shot on everything. With Hillary, you 100% are going to lose on 99% of the issues that are important to you. That's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. So I thought from Kirpin that and it's a paraphrase there, and even if he didn't say it, I'm giving him credit. It's an interesting way to look at Trump and the situation. Does it match what I want? No. Would it be my desire if I can get my way? No. But what if I can't get my way? What do I do? What is it that I stare at? What am I thinking about? So for me, as a host and me as a person, I think the best bet for me is a conversation about values and standards and what it is that we want in a society and how it is we go about getting them and how we hold to them even in the face of things not going our way, because sometimes things don't go our way. And how do we keep moving that forward? How do you keep the republic together? How do you keep this great thing going? Because that's what people are most fearful of, that the great thing is coming to an end because too many people don't think it's valuable.
Amen. Tony Katz, let's just leave it there. I think that was a perfect way to end it. I hope you have a fantastic weekend, sir.
A lot of dancing to do. A lot of dancing. Hot damn.
I'm picturing, is this going to be on ice at all?
Oh, listen, pop and lock, I invented that. That okay. is my jam. That's all I'm saying.
All right, listen, buddy. I will see you next week.
You got it.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Tony Katz, he is the host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. Unfortunately, we are almost out of time here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company. But again, big stories today. Governor of Virginia signing the reciprocity agreement. And the U.S. House as well passing out the SHARE Act, the bill that should expand opportunities for recreational shooters on federal land, including hopefully, again, better range access and more ranges around the country. Thank you so much for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Have yourself a fantastic weekend, and we'll see you here soon on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosley.